It's not just China, but also our government officials, you know, our elites obviously benefit from a fearful society, from fearful people. People are afraid that the world is going to end. Because what is a better way to get people to comply to the things that you say that they have to do than by, you know, having them actually fear for their lives? You know, that's always the globalist's tragedy. We've seen it with COVID, but the climate is probably even more effective because, well, if you really believe that the world's going to end, you know, what is there that you wouldn't do in order to save the planet? And so that strategy of creating a crisis, you know, of saying, well, we have an emergency and it needs to be solved now. We are on thin ice. We're all going to die. You know, that's incredibly effective. And the solution that they always present you with is that we, us ordinary people, have to give up our rights, our property, and our freedom in order to solve this so-called crisis. You know, it's always a rules for thee, but not for me type of situation. That is why we are the only ones that will end up not eating meat, not flying anymore, not being allowed to drive our cars. But for them, nothing ever changes.
So it's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on Friday, the 7th of April, 2023. A very good Friday to you all. Sorry we're a couple of minutes late. With a good old sort of, well, not good really, but an old COVID style remote program we're bringing to you now. We're not actually in the studio at the PRSC, but Dave Bazanko, our sound engineer, is. We are, so I suppose we are live from PRSC, just about, in Bristol, on the talkradio.stream. We're definitely there anyway, and at radioquk.com in Camberley, Surrey, live on Not the BCFM Politics Show app. I'm Tony Gosling. Thanks for turning off the psycho in the corner once more, especially on a lovely day like Good Friday with fantastic weather we've got here in Gloucestershire, and gaslighting us with its military grade zero carbon, zero trust, Ukraine, PSYOPs propaganda and continued suppression, of course, of the COVID jab injuries. Navigating us through the Fourth Reich Matrix this jolly Good Friday, or the WEF's Fourth Industrial Revolution, is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. In part one, we're going to have a look at the coronation, some of the articles that have been written about some of the problems with that. I mean, it certainly doesn't look as if it's going to make sense to have a World Economic Forum cheerleader as our head of state. Charlie also getting involved very much with things like the Northern Ireland Protocol, with his Windsor Declaration, or whatever it is. Also, we'll be talking to Maz Salim, whose father died on his way home from one of the Birmingham mosques 10 years ago. And what she's been discovering about the police and the way that they dealt with the case, and also the actual perpetrator, who it turns out was a Ukrainian Nazi who'd been recruited and brought to Birmingham by MI6. In part two, we hear from Tony Greenstein, his take on what's been going on over in Israel, particularly in on Temple Mount. Spoke to him yesterday evening, and also in Tel Aviv with the protests. A fascinating take he's got on it all, as usual. Also, we've had Ursula von der Leyen and Emmanuel Macron, Ursula and Emmanuel over in China, chatting with President Xi. I mean, are they going to come to some big alliance against the Russians? Who knows? And on our final, because of, you know, usual spiritual angle, we're having a look at Glastonbury and a certain guy down there called John Crowe seems to model himself on Aleister Crowley. Sandy Adams has got some news about some of his activities over the Easter weekend. It sounded a little bit unsavoury. And also something from David Livingstone on Sidney Reilly, this James Bond of the First World War and the turn of the century, back around 1900. So Iranian and Russian news cancelled. That's all now outside the firewall. Nice to be able to, from time to time, to bring you bits and pieces from outside the firewall, you know, like almost like imagine. Actually, I mean, it's lovely to be able to do this, because I bet in China, if you were to start broadcasting online or on FM or anywhere, stuff from outside the firewall, they come down on you like a ton of bricks. But anyway, so the Iranian and Russian news cancelled, first by the telecoms cartel, then by Ofcom, and then us cancelled off Bristol Community FM. Anyone see a pattern here? So, Martin, the big news, I suppose, this week has been the surprise at the weekend, or was it Monday, I think, of the arrest of Nicola Sturgeon's husband, isn't it? Were you surprised?
Well, there's been a lot of suspicions. Lots of rumours have been circulating about what's been going on there. I can't say that I've actually looked into it in a great deal of detail, but you can see that there's something amiss there, isn't there?
Yeah. So, what do you think it is?
Well, I think the police are investigating financial irregularities in the funding of an SNP. And of course, there was a big fight to, you know, Nicola Sturgeon and her husband were very much behind the prosecution of Alex Salmond. And of course, he eventually was acquitted by the jury of sexual misconduct, although he had to admit that he'd behaved in ways which were, although legal, extremely dubious. And I imagine that, there's some other things that have been going on in terms of what's been going on with the finances.
Well, she's put a statement out saying that she didn't know anything was going to happen to her husband before she resigned. Do you believe her?
I'm not sure I do. But on the other hand, I haven't got any evidence to suggest otherwise. I'm not investigating this stuff. I'm aware of it.
Well, you should be, really. I mean, you know, well, the idea that reason I say you should be is because it's a bit cheeky of me, I know, and it's almost designed to rile you, which I shouldn't be doing, especially on a day like this. But the fact is that when she resigned, you and I had quite a big difference there. You said, oh, no, it's just that she's had enough. And I'm saying, look, this very rarely happens. And it certainly looks now as if she had wind of it, especially when she puts a statement out saying she didn't know anything about it. Well, it now looks as if both her and her husband have been running a little. I mean, what's effectively happened is that a massive amount of money has come in for Scottish independence, and then it seems to have just disappeared into other bank accounts. And so obviously people are donating money to the party, to her husband, and her husband having control of this. And they had several people, haven't they, over the last few years resign. I think it was the financial director of the SNP, because he resigned about a year ago because he was saying he wasn't getting the information he needed to do his job, so he quite honourably resigned.
Yes, and I think if you look at Craig Murray's blog, he's taken some interest in these affairs, and of course he got caught up in the Salmon case because he was then sent to prison for contempt of court. So he's no big friend of Nicola Sturgeon, even though he's a very strong supporter of independence for Scotland.
So has she been trying to sabotage Scottish independence then? Because it sounds as although on one face she's saying we've got to have Scottish independence. On the other face, she's cooking the books. Or he is.
Well, the view she's taken is that we can't go for an illegal referendum. We've got to work within the existing British Constitution. There are some like Craig Murray, for example, who are of the opinion that they should just go for it and to hell with the existing British Constitution.
What they're signalling
in the SNP.
Yeah, I know what you're saying, but what they're signalling here is we're just as bad as Westminster.
Well, the SNP have been in power in Scotland effectively for over a decade, and when you're in power for that long, and your main goal of independence still remains elusive, you then end up running things as a managerial way. And of course, over time, you make mistakes. You don't do things that you said you were going to do. You do things that you didn't say you were going to do. And instead of being a new, fresh face in politics, it's more of the same old, same old.
It is. And I think maybe with Craig Murray, Craig Murray's realising, I mean, yes, of course, you know, any normal Scot is looking at Westminster, looking at Brussels as well, actually, and thinking, do we really want anything to do with this corruption? And then they slowly find out that actually the people that are supposedly leading the charge for their independence are just as corrupt. Craig Murray is saying, on Wednesday this week, the threat of imprisonment for contempt of court again looms over me if I tell you too much of the truth about the arrest of Nicola Sturgeon, which is rather worrying, isn't it? I mean, if he knows stuff, it may be that he'll be arrested again because, I mean, of course, you know, this is what's been going on in Scotland is journalists like him have been threatened effectively. Look, don't say what you know because you could go to jail for it. And I can make a few observations, he says. As I stated on Twitter on the 19th of March, Police Scotland delayed their investigation into SNP corruption for the duration of the leadership election campaign. That campaign was triggered by Sturgeon's sudden resignation, which was itself precipitated by her being told by the police. And that's what he's saying as a fact. But the implication there is, Martin, that the person who's now been elected was deliberately, the election was deliberately allowed to run. Humza Yousaf was deliberately elected as the continuity Sturgeon candidate without any of the electorate knowing that this police investigation was pending. And really, if the police were doing their job properly, they wouldn't have flagged this up. They would have just arrested the guy.
Well, that's all fair comment. And Craig Murray has made that comment. We shall see what happens, won't we?
I tend to agree with him, don't you?
Well, I think it's quite likely that he's got the right end of the stick here. He sometimes gets the wrong end of the stick, in my view. I don't know enough about it, Tony, is the truth of the matter.
Yeah.
I can see that there's something going on here, and I can see that if I was a Scottish elector, which I'm not, I would be very concerned about it. It's one of the things that has been in the news this week, but it's not the only thing.
Well, I mean, that's a bit of a trite comment. I mean, one of the main stories.
I do not know. Do you know what he's done? Would you like to state what you think he's done?
Remember that there is a court case pending now. He's being charged. And so we have to be a little bit careful about what we say. But certainly what he's accused of doing, and this has been around for a long time, is taking party funds for his own use. And the money which has been donated, massive amounts of it, for the campaign for Scottish independence has been misused and abused by the party. So I suppose what I'm saying, Martin, ultimately is this: the SNP has been working effectively by trying to cover all this stuff up against the cause for Scottish independence, which is not going to bode well for them, is it?
Well, I mean, any political party that gets into a situation like this is in trouble. Let's face it. You don't want this kind of allegation circulating around, do you? It's not going to make people more likely to vote for you, is it? That's an issue.
No, it is. You're right. Anyway, I think
whatever the goals of the party, independence being obviously a prime goal for them, if you want to achieve something, then you can't get caught with your pants down over things like this, can you? It's not the best way to do it, is it?
It's been some anti-independence movement made by the police again.
Mess up their own. You see it happen all the time in games of football. People score own goals. They shouldn't. It's stupid, but they do. And sometimes it can't be helped, you know.
I think it also makes sense to look at the global situation, which is, I mean, I've always maintained, you know, I'm no big fan of Nicola Sturgeon, and I don't really trust anything she says. But there is, I mean, there was her links to this thing called the European Council on Foreign Relations, which I've always found really annoying. I mean, she basically stands there talking about this, that, and everything else. But I think really her role seems to be to do deals with people behind the scenes just to make Scotland a good place for investors, particularly big US investors, you know, your Black Rocks and people like that. And in the background to all of this is this, you know, awful financial situation which everyone is having to deal with. And I mean, we had a piece on a couple of months ago from a wonderful woman who was talking about, well, isn't it great because all of these people who we're being trained to hate, like Sturgeon, calling them corrupt, etc., seeing our corrupt politicians, the end result of it is that this is providing actually quite a red carpet for the big corporations to take over, saying, well, actually, politics is broken, the democratic system doesn't work, Martin.
Well, I mean, it's quite possible, and Nicola Sturgeon sees herself as a moderate nationalist, a civic nationalist, and therefore, of course, she's got no truck with violence in theory. And also, of course, she wants to make Scotland a good place to live for people, for investors and all the rest of it. And so, therefore, like most mainstream politicians, she has to have funding to do what she does, and the funds come from the people with funds. And they've got their demands. And it's true of the SNP. It's certainly true of the Conservative Party. It's true of the Republican Party of the United States. Who pays the piper calls the tune. And if you want to change that, you've got to change a whole lot of things.
You missed out the Labour Party there.
Well, the Labour Party has got problems with funding as well. Because of
well,
course,
it has. It's yeah, by moving the away from the unions.
Used to fund it, and of course, the unions, many unions do not fund it now. And therefore, Keir Starmer, we used to have a mass membership, and that gave us a load of resources. A lot of that money was thrown away in the court case taken by the former employees of the party who claimed that they've been discriminated against for anti-Semitism, and they got millions of pounds of payout. They shouldn't have got it. It should have gone to court, and they should have been told you can't have it. But of course, funding, money, is always fundamental in politics. Of course, it's
we were talking about this last week, weren't we? But anyway, let's look at the global financial situation now, because there is all sorts of talk. Well, we've had these banking wobbles, etc. Before we hear from William Engdahl, Martin, can you give us your take on this whole idea of jacking up interest rates? We've talked about this over the last few months, and it does seem, I mean, we might even be in agreement for a change on this, that the actual ratcheting up of interest rates is actually more likely to cause financial crash or troubles than it is to alleviate them, because we're being told all the time, oh, we need to up interest rates to keep down inflation. So can you just pull that a bit apart for us?
Well, a lot of things in economics, like in life in general, there's a trade-off. And if you want to bring there are ways of dealing with supply side inflation other than by raising interest rates, but nevertheless, we've got ourselves into a situation with independent central banks, supposedly, and they see their role as raising interest rates to prevent inflation, particularly wage inflation. They don't.
Okay, can you explain what you mean by supply?
But if you do that,
when you say supply side inflation, can you say what other, you know, what's that balanced up against?
Supply side inflation is where things like, you know, the sanctions on Russia have massively backfired on the West. It's not that the Russians invaded the Ukraine and that's what's caused the prices to rise. What's caused the prices to rise is the West's attempt to try and bring down the Russian economy, which has backfired. And of course, the Russians are not experiencing many big inflation, not least because they're self-sufficient in things like oil and gas.
Food prices have been falling in Russia.
Yes, that's right. So in other words, there was a bit of a shock because they had to adapt, but they've now adapted. But it's the Western countries which are suffering from inflation as a result of their own policies. Now, the only way to, you know, the way to solve that is to do a deal with the Russians, which they're not prepared to do. Or the only other way to get inflation down that they know how to do is to raise interest rates. And it will bring inflation down, but by crashing the banking system and therefore pushing the whole economy into a depression.
That's, well, this is great for the this is fantastic.
And that will bring inflation down.
Yeah, but it's great for the likes of.
You might get stagflationary depression, which is what you got in Russia in the 1990s, where you've got roaring inflation and the economy collapsing simultaneously.
So what's your prediction? What's your prediction?
Well, I think we're probably just going to get a big depression. That's the most likely outcome. Because all these debts, which have been run up with QE, they're totally dependent on a low rate of interest. Otherwise, they can't be managed. And therefore, the banks are now finding that they can't manage it. There's a huge $1 trillion derivatives market out there, which is just going to go pop at some point. And if the banking system collapses, that will be the economy will collapse. And the 1930s with a world war on top of it. And it's not going to be pleasant, is it?
Okay, well, let's listen to William. I mean, Martin, for many years you've been saying, oh, this year looks like it. Well, to me, this year really does.
Yeah, but it doesn't happen until it does happen. And don't forget, they've thrown the textbook away and they're prepared to print any amount of money. And if you're prepared to print any amount of money, then you can probably sustain the bubble for you know, in the past they wouldn't have dared because they knew it was a bubble. But now they've just said it's a bubble, so what? Let's just carry on. And, of course, eventually it bursts. Of course it does.
Well, Patrick Henningsen from the sort of UK column, etc. I mean, I'm very critical of him these days. I mean, he's come out as one of these people that says there was no such thing as the virus. In fact, he states it as fact quite regularly.
Yes.
And, you know, I've asked him several times to do interviews and he sort of laughs at me and, well, no, oh, so you just phoned me. Yeah, well, that's because that's what journalism is, you know, and you can talk to me. And he's always said no. But here he is talking to William Engdahl this week. So several people have asked me, well, why do you think he's a bit iffy? Well, that's why he's backing this whole there is no virus David Icke line, which is a psyop. So anyway, here's F. William Engdahl And his book is called The Gods of Money. So let's have a listen to him now talking about what he thinks is a global financial collapse this week with Patrick Henningsen.
We've had 14 years of unprecedented zero or near zero interest rates, not only from the Fed, but from central banks around the world. The European Central Bank actually went into minus interest rates for a while. So we've had this extraordinary free money situation so that banks who are lending would lend to every fly shop operation that comes along that they can, you know, get some short-term gains from. And that's what's happened. We've had bubbles created in almost everything you can imagine. The housing bubble of the last several years, the automobile financing bubble, the college loan bubble, everything you can look at. So now all of this with the high interest rates, they can't roll over that debt. So they're going to have to sell assets like government bonds that it's been holding, which have been dramatically losing value because the interest rates have been going up in the market from the central banks, especially the Fed.
So how is this situation going to affect BlackRock, Vanguard, State Street, these massive hedge funds, these massive funds? Are they going to take advantage of this? Could you see any vulture capitalistic moves going on here that might, let's say, reconsolidate wealth in a certain direction? What do you think on that front?
I think we're several steps away from them being able to do that because they are going to face horrendous losses on their stock holdings, on their bond holdings for their investors, the middle America that's invested trillions of dollars into these BlackRock, Vanguard, State Street Bank, and so forth. So there's going to be horrendous downside in the stock market that's not even yet begun. Because of this. This is my feeling. But let me step back, if I may, a little bit and say something about the role of central banks and the Federal Reserve in financial collapses in general in history over the last 110 years since the Fed was created in 1913. Every major financial crisis and collapse that the United States has undergone since the Fed was created in 1913 has been deliberately activated by the Fed through interest rate policies. Mm-hmm. That happened in 1929. The stock market collapse, I document that in my Gods of Money, Wall Street and the Death of the American Century book. That happened with the collapse of the U.S. banking system that was a domino effect of the collapse of the Vienna Kreditanstalt in May of 1931 that collapsed the German banking system to which Wall Street, J.P. Morgan, and other banks had lent billions of dollars over the 1920s. So the whole thing began to come unwound, but that prepared the way for World War II by the powers that be. Well, the 2008 Great Financial Crisis, as it's called, was triggered deliberately by Henry Paulson, who came from Goldman Sachs as Treasury Secretary, when he refused to bail out Lehman Brothers in September of 2008. So all of these financial crises are deliberately created by the money power. Now Janet Yellen, the Treasury Secretary, former chairman of the Federal Reserve, came out today on Sunday talk show saying that we will not have bailouts like we did in 2008 of the banks. What she didn't say is, in the meantime, they have instituted laws that they refuse to talk about publicly in front of the general public called bank bail-ins. And that's what's going to happen now, that the banks that are insolvent have bank depositor runs, panic runs, and so forth, are not going to be bailed out by the taxpayers as we did in 08. It's going to be the depositors, like in Cyprus a few years ago with the banks in Cyprus, where the depositors were forced to take a haircut to lose billions of dollars of their own deposit money. in the bank in Cyprus. Well, that now has been codified into law in the European Union with the banks of the European Union, which are in very, very bad shape, and the banks in the United States. So this is going to be the next step. Bank bail-ins, so people with unsecured deposits over $250,000, like corporations and so forth, are going to be left holding the bag.
It's William Engdahl there speaking to Patrick Henningsen. I mean, neither you nor I have got deposits of $250,000, Martin. I don't imagine you have anywhere. I certainly haven't. But, you know, what he's saying there effectively is that there won't be bailouts. I mean, you've said this in the past. And also, he's suggesting that the ground has been slowly shifting. And I'm sure that the British banks are just as exposed as the US and the EU banks. But yeah, whereabouts are we heading with all this?
Well, just to pick up one point, Silicon Valley Bank, they got quite a few depositors who had more than $250,000 in the bank. And because they did have more than $250,000, they realized that they weren't insured and that their deposits weren't secure. So those people, mostly sort of tech entrepreneurs in Silicon Valley, took their money out of the bank, thus making it insolvent. But the Biden administration then stepped in and said, don't worry, we will make all of those, we'll insure everybody's deposits. So when William Engdahl says there that they're not going to insure deposits, the Biden administration just stepped. Now, they only said it in relation to Silicon Valley Bank, but the implication is that that's what they're going to do for all deposits. Now, this is the end game, really, where you can't rob Peter to pay Paul anymore, and somebody's got to take the hit. And of course, you know who's going to take the hit. It's going to be the bottom 50% of the population.
It's also, I'm reminded of the government's indemnification of the vaccine injuries too. So it almost looks as if, you know, we've got a fascist system with our taxpayers' money just being used as an insurance policy for them.
That's right. It's socialism for the rich and devil take the hindmost for everybody else. I mean, you know, it's the people who ran Silicon Valley Bank were all and people who put their money in it were all very much against government intervention and, you know, that the market should just be allowed to operate and all the rest of it. But as soon as their money's at risk, then they're totally opposed to it and the government's got to step in and do something. And of course, this is what happened in 2008. It's probably going to be more complicated now because the debt trap is bigger and more complex. Nobody really understands what's going on in the derivatives market because it's totally opaque. So something could blow up there and just, as Warren Buffett said, derivatives are financial weapons of mass destruction. And of course, this when Credit Suisse went down, people had bought credit default swaps on it, but they didn't get any money. They were cut out and the shareholders were cut in. Now, in other words, whatever they said they were going to do, when something like this happened, it's turning into they're just making it up as they go along when something happens.
Well, of course, as well as if you're on the inside of what is secretly being planned when a bank does go down, if you're on the inside of that, you can make an absolute fortune. So it's just mass inside.
Loads of people made a load of money in 2008 because they were on the right side of the trades and all the rest of it.
Yeah, and they're continuing to do it.
In November 2019, there was a similar meltdown in the repo market in the US, but we didn't know anything about it because they'd actually got a plan to go to bail it out, which is when BlackRock took over the Federal Reserve. And this is just at the same time as the virus, which I believe does exist, Tony, was circulating in China, and the Israeli Defense Forces were tipped off about a virus coming out of China. All of which seems to me circumstantial evidence that all of these things are related. Now, what Engdahl's suggesting there is that these financial collapses are to some extent orchestrated. I think there's an element of truth in that. The basic direction of the system is in any case boom, bust, and slump. It's always been there. You know, that's how capitalism functions. But if you know that it's going to do that and you are big enough, you can manipulate all of it. I mean, a crash and a depression will be obviously smashed smash workers' wages all over the world. All sorts of assets will become available for pennies on the dollar. And if you're sitting on a big pile of money, you'll be able to buy everything up to peanuts. And that's
what makes this so easy to do nowadays is there's, I mean, since we've had the financial deregulation, the getting rid of exchange controls we had, we were talking about last week, we've got the big bang, the deregulation. This makes this a cakewalk for the banksters, doesn't it?
It does. And of course, even when they mess up, they get bailed out. So the film The Big Short, I don't know if you've seen it, it's about people, you know, it's a fictional version of events, but it's quite amusing. And of course, the people in The Big Short, they realise that the banking system was insolvent, and they took bets to that it would collapse. And eventually those bets came true when in the collapse in 2008, and they made quite a lot of money at it. But the guy who wrote the book, The Big Short, then went back to his previous boss at one of the big banks, I can't remember which one, and he said, oh, you've become famous, haven't you, for betting against the banking system? And you've become quite famous because you predicted it all, and you've made yourself quite wealthy, haven't you? How much are you worth? And he said, well, I'm worth twice that for getting it wrong. So who's a mug, me or you?
Well, anyway, I mean, this stuff has been going on for a very, very long time. I mean, we're talking really here about fascist companies who are just kind of basically doing whatever they want, and they're running rings around the press, running rings around the government. And in fact, the government is often just bending over to do whatever they want because they're funding it or threatening it or threatening to sue it. A very, very weak government.
The finances, then you're in a strong position, aren't you?
Yeah, I mean, and also you can also
nobody was prosecuted this 2008. Nobody at all, apart from Bernie Madoff. In the SNL collapse in the 1980s, over 1,000 executives of the Savings and Loans Organisation were sent to prison. That didn't happen in 2008.
Well, we've also had Michael Tyler's brilliant piece. This is his blog. Which looked at all the dead bankers. That was in 2016 and 2017. Loads and loads of bankers so-called committing suicide in ways that were impossible, like shooting themselves several times in the head and this kind of thing. So something's definitely going on. It's almost as if the banking system is being consolidated and controlled and used, weaponized against humanity. But this has been going on for quite a long time. So if we go back now to the year 2000, I interviewed a guy called Mark Purdy. And ever since the start of this year, I've been peppering our shows every few weeks with another excerpt from this brilliant interview that he did. He's dead now. Suspicious circumstances around his dying. He's from the Purdy Gun family. But he was an organic dairy farmer down in Dorset when I met him and interviewed him in 2000. So let's have a listen to the latest, which is the fifth, just past the halfway mark of eight different sections of the interview I did with him about BSE and CJD. Now, his hypothesis, which to me is absolutely 100% cast iron true, is that the use of organophosphate pesticides was what was causing both mad cow disease and the CJD in humans, and that the chemical company ICI, who produced this organophosphate, which was, by the way, the Ministry of Agriculture were forcing farmers to use on cows. The Ministry of Agriculture were forcing them to use this stuff, which was absolutely completely toxifying the food chain in this hideous fashion and turning these cows into nutters, and they were going completely crazy. But anyway, here's Mark Purdy's the latest from him. Talking about what the long-term effect of these organophosphate pesticides, which were dreamt up by the Nazis, is on human health.
There is a strong genetic susceptibility element to any disease, whether it's a cancer or a neurological disease like multiple sclerosis. We're all born with weaknesses in our body just through our genetic makeup. But the actual determination as to whether we're going to get that disease in our lives is linked to what we encounter, what we're challenged by in our daily environment. And as the use of a whole bizarre range of chemicals has increased in our environment, that's been triggering off diseases, perhaps to surface earlier in people in the modern world. And the chemicals are not only used, you know, they're used in farming, they're put into the source of the food chain. From there, they're getting into the water supplies, they're in the rain. I mean, they're appearing in as far away areas such as Iceland, affecting the polar bears. They get into the fat of animals throughout the entire food chain and build up the food chain, which was well evidenced by the effects of DDT in the middle of last century. In the modern world, I mean, I think it's become very apparent that, you know, I run an organic farm where I'm not putting in a whole sort of array of chemicals into my cattle. And literally, our vet bill 2 years ago was only £60, which I think a lot of farmers just wouldn't believe it, you know. We have TB in some of the herds around us. Those cattle are, you know, having those badgers, the cattle are having contact with my cows, but my cows aren't getting TB. They always pass the test because I believe their immune systems are intact. They have a healthy immune system because a lot of the chemicals that are used in modern agriculture, they attack directly at the T cells, which is the fundamental mainstay of the immune system. If you take those away, then a whole range of viruses, bacteria that are endemic in our environment will suddenly get a hold. That's why, once you've damaged the immune system, then you can get a whole load of viruses. But I think the establishment is very quick to blame the virus because, as the primary cause, you know, the virus is the primary cause because nobody's responsible for a virus. It's not yet mass manufactured. So no one can be held accountable. So it's a very convenient scapegoat to blame a virus. A lot of ME sufferers find that they have a whole host of bacteria and viruses that have taken a hold in their systems. And they've never found one single virus to pin to cause the blame on. And this is classic of a case where there's been an immune wipeout, so that any virus that is endemic in their particular environment just gets in there. And this is, in a sense, it shows the futility of some of, for instance, the vaccination programs that our children are being subjected to. Because those children, what we need to concentrate on is maintaining a healthy immune system so they can survive the daily challenge of E. coli or Coxsackie or whatever's in their particular environment. The answer to good health is nurturing a healthy immune system. And it's not sort of vaccinating people against things that are all around us. I mean, meningitis is living in most of our throats all the time. And someone gets meningitis when they're exposed to something that destroys the immune response in the saliva, the antibodies in the saliva. One of the key areas that organophosphates hit is a neurotransmitter, a sort of hormone in the brain called serotonin. And organophosphates actually sort of at low levels burn off the endings of the serotonin. And serotonin sort of presides over the whole immune system, the immune response system. It presides over the amount of lymphocytes that are released into the circulation, both the T lymphocytes and the B lymphocytes. And it is through a disruption of the lymphocyte system that you get what's called sensitization. And this is the seeding of allergies that are occurring very frequently now in humanity. For instance, allergies like asthma, eczema, irritable bowel syndrome. At the skin surfaces, it seems to be becoming very apparent that somehow we can no longer cope with innocuous substances that we come into touch with in daily life. For instance, house dust, pollen, things that normally we could withstand suddenly become highly toxic and dangerous substances that start triggering off allergy reactions. And this is caused, I believe, by an underlying disturbance to this serotonin system, which is exactly where organophosphates strike. And in fact, it's enshrined into the medical literature, the way organophosphates interact with this serotonin hormone in the brain and cause this very disturbance which is definitely at the root of the allergic reaction. Other problems that can be caused are the fact that the organophosphates themselves bond onto proteins and into fats in parts of the brain, in membranes, in the body. And when they bond onto, say, a protein, that protein takes on a higher molecular weight, it becomes heavier. And the way the immune system works is that when a protein is too heavy, the immune system, the B lymphocytes, see that protein as an alien because it's too heavy for what the body should normally have inside it. And so the B lymphocytes attack that protein and start destroying it and cause what is known as an autoimmune reaction. A very good example of this is multiple sclerosis, where in the brain, the myelin sheath, which is a sort of group of proteins that insulate the nerves, they become attacked by the B lymphocytes in a relapse in multiple sclerosis. And in fact, a lot of pesticides, not just organophosphates, are known to bond on to this myelin protein. And because they're known to bond onto it, they're going to increase the molecular weight of these proteins. And therefore that tricks the body, the B lymphocytes, into attacking that protein because they think it's foreign. They think it's something that shouldn't be inside the brain. So they attack it and destroy it and strip away this myelin sheath, which is the insulation of the nerves. So nerves can no longer conduct their impulses. They're not insulated anymore. So the impulse system collapses. And that's essentially what you get in multiple sclerosis. So it's very disturbing, this whole range of symptoms that pesticides such as organophosphates can create, both the allergic type of responses and the autoimmune types of responses.
Amazing. So anything from irritable bowel syndrome right the way through to ordinary allergies. He's really explaining, I think, and he seems to have gone, and that's Mark Purdy, by the way, into it so deeply, into the understanding of the way the immune system works, that in a similar way to many have gone into understanding this stuff through COVID. And also, Martin, interesting to hear him talking about the the idea that, well, why are we vaccinating our kids? Amazing story. That about his herd, you know, he's got had a large organic dairy herd, and he's saying he's having hardly any health problems because he's just keeping the cows away from any chemicals or treatments.
Well, I mean, I hear what he says. I mean, that may well be so, but of course it's just anecdotal unless you've got scientific evidence to back it up.
Well, he's got a tremendous amount of scientific evidence. I think it's rather rude of you to just dismiss him in that way.
I'm not dismissing him.
He's an experienced dairy farmer.
That's okay. It's
not anecdotal, is it? He's been treating his cows. This is during the height of mad cow disease, and he's come up with a way to stop any of his cows getting that disease and also to be able to sell safe meat just simply by being an organic farmer. I mean, it's not anecdotal at all.
Safe milk, not meat, but yes.
He's in the middle of it, both, yeah.
Well, I mean, the we've known about this since Rachel Carson's Silent Spring in 1962, haven't we? But, of course, the agribusiness interests that dominate the West, and therefore, you know, the people that are chopping down rainforests in Brazil to put cattle on what used to be rainforests to make burgers for people to eat in California and all the rest of it, we know what's going on. And we need land reform all over the world so that small farmers using traditional methods can feed themselves and their families and gradually come up the development ladder, as it were. But that's prevented in many countries, as Michael Hudson has pointed out. The Americans and the American capitalists want tropical countries to be growing tropical goods to be sold in the West, not to be growing food for their own people. Which is why, you know, big landowners, latifundistas in Brazil, they own most of the land. They are very much behind the Bolsonaro phenomenon and all the rest of it. And they don't want to change. And it's a battle everywhere.
Well, it is, yeah. And just a brief look at the coronation, because the king's invite was published this week, and on it he talks about Camilla as the queen. Well, that's not what his mum wanted. It's not what his mum said. In fact, there was a very good reason why his mother said she can't be queen, and that is because Charles was the party at fault in the divorce with Diana, and the law says that, you know, I'm afraid she's going to have to be queen consort. Do you think it makes any difference whether she's called queen consort or the queen, Martin? Because certainly Charlie's mum did, and the law of the land says she can't be, but now apparently because Charles is the head of the Church of England, he can overrule this and now say, well, actually, the advice from the Church of England is that she can be queen, that it doesn't matter about the divorce anymore.
Well, I can't say that I've got a dog in this fight, Tony. I don't care what they call her. We shouldn't have a monarchy at all, in my view.
I think there's a lot of people saying that.
There's contradictions involved in this, isn't there?
I mean, you know, for me, it's largely, I mean, it's a very interesting invite he's published with this green man on it, which is the first time we've seen that on an invite to a coronation. I mean, it does, you do get the idea that he's kind of cocking a snook at Christians in that he's saying, well, look, you know, I'm going to go through this ceremony, talk about being a Christian, but actually, look, there's a green man on the thing. So do you want to just say, what is the green man? What do you understand it as?
Well, the green man is a medieval phenomenon, really. I'm in Herefordshire here at the moment, and there are green men carved into Kilpeck Church, where I think I've taken you. And it's a sort of nature spirit.
And as far Martin, just a second, because as far as I know, the green man was in many of the Norman churches, but not the Saxon churches.
Well, it's a later medieval thing. It didn't go back to pagan times. It's a medieval thing. So, you know, I mean, there wasn't much carving in Saxon churches of any kind. So there you are, you know. I mean, the Herefordshire school here, which is in about the 1100s, they're famous because they carry out what are extremely ingenious carvings, some of which have very little to do with what you might call Christian symbolism. They are actually, you know, jeu d'esprit. You know, they are whatever whatever the carvers wanted to carve.
What about all these? I mean, the cathedrals had these misericords, didn't they? With all these carvings underneath the monks.
Well, that's right.
I mean, singers. Yeah, I mean, so there is a lot of pagan symbolism. I mean,
the medieval society was extremely complicated, and what people believed wouldn't be recognised by modern Christians, and they wouldn't recognise modern Christianity because they.
There are certain things, overwhelming church,
but most people couldn't read, so they didn't get their Christianity from books, and their beliefs were actually quite complicated. And in rural parts of the world, people still believed in things like fairies and so on,
But the core of the Christian belief is very simple, isn't it? Christ dying on the cross and being resurrected at this time of year is pretty simple. And I think, you know, it's quite clear the guilds were a large part, the medieval guilds were a large part of putting these kind of bits of symbolism in the church, in a way, a kind of elite of their day, where none of the people who are attending a church or a cathedral would ever see these because they were hidden underneath the seats, but they were there anyway. And the reason I'm talking about Charles particularly is not specifically about the coronation, but looking at what Mark Purdy was just talking about, the environment there is no understanding and explanation of the evil chemicals and stuff that have been pouring into the environment, really. And it's not been pulled apart properly. So the real there's also a fascinating story in the iPaper this week. I was flicking through. Climate change plan relies on growing crops to burn. So this is a wonderful new thing that they're doing. The government's new climate change plan is calling for more land to be dedicated to planting crops to burn for energy than for new woodland. So enormous amounts of land, Martin, hundreds of thousands of acres are now being earmarked by central government to grow various things, mostly wood, to stick in a Drax power station, burn it, and make this doesn't sound really very environmental to me. In fact, I'm sure you remember there was a Michael Moore film a couple of years ago called Planet of the Humans, which went into this. This is this bizarre idea that actually the biomass is a brilliant way of doing things. Of course, it's incredibly destructive to the environment. And Drax Power Station has been turned pretty much from a coal-fired power station into burning this biomass, and they're importing it from – they don't really seem to care where they import it from around the world, but it is environmentally destructive to do that, surely, to just put biomass in a power station.
Yeah, well, in the developing world, growing stuff to burn, you know, to use for biofuel is another of the factors that pushes small farmers – out of the capacity to farm. We need a land reform all over the world, but a land reform means a revolution. In Nicaragua, they had to fight a war against US-backed dictatorship before they could have a land reform, and hundreds of thousands of people were killed. It's not just a reform that Prince Charles talks about having organic farms, and he sees himself as a bit of an environmentalist, but I'm afraid lots of the demands of the farmers in the developing world are revolutionary demands, same as in China, same as in North Korea and other places. Ultimately, it's a battle between the haves and the have-nots, and it isn't something where we're all going to have a nice green future by being cuddly with each other. It just isn't – that isn't what's going to happen.
No, it certainly isn't. This is part of the 2030 plan, Agenda 2030, and of course, zero carbon, complete zero carbon by 2050. It just seems, we had David Douglas on a few weeks ago, ex National Union of Mine Workers guy, pointing out that actually, whether or not you like coal, you have to look around the world to see the indexes of poverty and the countries with the best conditions for living. Life expectancy, this sort of thing, it correlates with their use of these fossil fuels. So this is the one thing they're not really telling us in all this so-called environmentalism. But anyway, this week I spoke to one of the country's top campaigners and thinkers and writers on the zero carbon agenda, and that's Sandy Adams. So we're going to hear her now just talking about what's been going on in Glastonbury. The first clip with her, please.
I do believe that it's got a special energy. I do. It's on, you know, an energy line. And let's face it, this is why the World Economic Forum were on St. Michael's Mount doing a very, very dubious ceremony during the G20 in Carbis Bay, when they were in Carbis Bay. I mean, the other side that, you know, the baddies use these energy lines. They use black magic at the end of the day. And I think there are energy lines, and I think they can be used for good or bad. And Glastonbury sits on a very powerful energy line, the Michael Mary line. And, you know, yes, it's definitely a place where people gravitate to, and pilgrims have come here for years and years and years, as you know. And the high history of Glastonbury is very, it's got a very deep Christian, Celtic Christian and Druidic Christian background, you know, early on. And I think somehow it's also a place where people come to when they're drawn here, because they need help, they need healing. So you do have people come here looking, searching to find what they think is external, but which is in within, you know, as we all know. It's within us. And so you do end up with people with alcohol and drug problems, you know, because of the festival is always a bit of a crazy time here. The week after the festival, you get a lot of people that just will never go home. You know, they just want to stay here.
What do you make of Glastonbury, Martin?
Well, I'm a child of my generation. I've not actually been to a Glastonbury festival, but I've often been to the town to have a look round and so on. It was always been a place of alternative stuff. It was going in the 1920s. You got sort of writers, and John Cowper Powers wrote a Glastonbury romance about Glastonbury. It obviously goes. It's got a lot of Christian heritage. It's probably got pagan heritage before that. So, you know, when Britain has been inhabited for many thousands of years, and it's quite a small place. And, there's plenty of places like Glastonbury around, you know, Stonehenge, Avebury, what have you.
I'm talking really about the town and about the Abbey. And I remember when I went down there to do an interview with them, which is about an hour and 45 minutes altogether. It's over two sessions over the space of about 6 or 8 months. That they were explaining that actually Glastonbury was a very powerful abbey before the dissolution, as powerful as Westminster Abbey. And when I say powerful, I mean lots of debt. And the reason that Henry VIII got rid of these abbeys was nothing to do with at all with religion, really. It was about the debt. And because the aristocracy all over the country, and particularly Henry, had been borrowing money from the abbeys. And of course, the easiest way to not have to pay that debt back was to just abolish them, kill the abbot, as they did in Glastonbury and other places, and then just steal all the property that's there as well and flog it off through some sort of rather nasty judicial process organised by a guy called Thomas Cromwell, who was the great, I think, great-great-grandfather of Oliver Cromwell, a hundred or so years later, the main, you know, guy from the English Civil War. So an interesting spot. But look, there has been a talk about this whole sort of fake environmentalism, this whole zero carbon stuff. I thought an excellent one by Sandy Adams at Glastonbury Town Council. So let's have a listen now to its couple of minutes of her talking to Glastonbury Town Council and trying to persuade them not to get on board with this 15-minute cities and the zero carbon agenda.
I've given you all the absolute zero document, and I hope you'll read it, because that coloured bit shows you what is to be achieved by 2030. And that means no flying out of the UK, no ships out of the UK, no cars at all, and no, you know, all wood burners to be ripped out of every home and every gas appliance to be ripped out of every home by 2025. Now, that is a government document, UK fires, absolute zero. And this is where we're heading for in net zero. We will literally be imprisoned on our own island. And, this is what this top-down global control is all about. You think it's a green agenda to actually save the planet. It is not. It was implemented at the Earth Summit in 1992, by a bunch of oil billionaires, crooks. And all of you, bless you, are trying to save the planet, and you've been hoodwinked. I was in the Green Party in the 1990s. I left. I was a member of the Ecology Party. I left because it got taken over. It became a Trojan horse for the technocratic agenda that I'm talking about, Agenda 2030. And I tell you what, they planned this from the 1970s. It's a long-term agenda. And I would love to be able to give all of you a presentation. I've been on this for 15 years, and I've been giving talks all over the world about this via YouTube, everywhere, because I'm passionate about it. I've impoverished myself doing this. So I just want you to just hear me out. We're living now in what's known as a zero trust world. So whether you know it or not, the digital ID is coming. Now, this is a big thing for everyone to understand. Digital ID is really the way the government will actually have all your data in one place. And they're bringing this in by December this year. This is really serious. And then they want the CBDCs after that, the central banking digital currencies. Now, this has got nothing to do with being green. It's big business. It's massive business, because underpinning this whole agenda are capitalist stakeholders. Now, this is what's worrying, is that this whole green agenda is based on top-down control of us, we the people. And unfortunately, people who literally glue themselves to buildings, bless them, they've got their best intention, our best intentions at heart. They're barking up the wrong tree. They're actually supporting the people who want to imprison us.
So there's Sandy Adams, Martin. Is she paranoid?
Well, I can see why she's saying what she's saying, because capitalism is going into a major crisis, and the resolution of it will be some form of authoritarian system. And the people in charge of this want to see that, you know, the people who've caused most of the damage, the big corporations, the oil companies, the arms companies, the banks, they want to see us to see them as the solution to the problems, because they're going to be green and they're going to transform themselves. I don't believe that. I think they've got to be smashed. And it's actually, we're going to go back to old-fashioned political
struggles. Well, there's a certain amount.
And the people paranoid about being taken over are missing. Large parts of the world are uncontrollable. They want to control them, but they can't. And they're going to find that that's the case even in developed countries. So
I mean, the main problem here seems to be
is paranoia, because it's probably just going to be endemic social conflict, which won't be.
You may be right, but I suppose
the society at all.
The important point to make about what Sandy's saying there is she does certainly seem to be right in that there is, and then she goes on to talk about an elite being able to pretty much do what they want, whilst the rest of us have to follow these Save the Planet guidelines. And what we've had over the last 10 years, all these little bits of legislation trickling in, with none of the politicians at the time, all thinking this is great, isn't it wonderful, we're going to save the planet, none of them actually looking and seeing where is this actually heading to. And what are the implications of this? I mean, we've seen this recently in Bristol with the imposition of this clean air zone, which is clearly designed to try and be a beginning of keeping, I mean, road pricing effectively, so that the government can just literally every few weeks or whenever it feels like, click, 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 it can charge you more and more and more for everywhere you drive in a car. And obviously, you know, the ultimate aim of that maybe just have no cars at all, never mind electric cars, which you can't mine anymore because there's wars going on or whatever. But anyway, we're going to be hearing some more from Sandy right at the end of the show, but this is the last clip right now where she's explaining what she thinks is the main element of this Agenda 21, Agenda 2030, when she was speaking to me this week about smart cities in Agenda 2030.
I'm against the smart city agenda altogether, and I know that obviously Bristol's is a flagship smart city of Europe, isn't it? Because I feel that the AI that they're putting into these cities is quite pernicious. It's a smog of EMFs. It's a very unhealthy environment for people to live in. But not only that, it's the data surveillance, data harvesting, the fact that your data is not safe. They can pick it up off your phone as you're walking past one of these sensors and lampposts and all that stuff that they're putting in. And, the thing is that I don't think humans were meant to live in that sort of environment anyway. Some people love cities and they will always live in cities. But I think you need to have the choice. But Agenda 21 removes that choice of living. Ultimately, their aim is for everyone to live in urban environments. And I feel that the 15-minute cities, they're trying to accelerate Agenda 2030 for whatever reason. And whether it's because we're waking up or whether it's because there's earth changes that they know about, who knows? But there has been a directive to accelerate it. And we've talked about accelerationism in the past. And it's a massive acceleration of Agenda 2030. So what they've done is they've created this 15-minute city thing, which, to be honest, has been around since the early 2000s, with Ken Livingstone and he started it, and the C40, mayors and the C40 cities. But it's become, obviously, they've made it a reality, but it's just been forced on everyone. And it's a form of locking us down in our own environment, in our own, cities or towns. And the LTNs, the low traffic neighbourhoods, are a form of restricting movement, that they're not quite if you were going to do an LTN, it would be in somewhere like Glastonbury, because you can actually reach everything within 15 minutes. But an LTN, could mean that they pedestrianise the high street and they make it difficult and everybody's going around the ring road and, all that kind of thing. And it's really funny because some massive planters were delivered last year to the town, and they were huge. They looked like sort of water tanks. They're riveted down the side and they've got a little logo of the tour in metal on them. But they were huge and they put saplings in them and they distributed them all the way down the high street, and the pavements weren't wide enough to take them. And all the residents complained. They said, you can't get wheelchairs down there. You can't. When the tourists come, there's not enough room on the pavements and all this sort of thing. So they they took them down and they put them in one of the car parks. I think there's only one at the top of the high street now, but they were huge, you know, 4 foot square, massive galvanized metal planters. And I knew exactly what they were for. And actually a few people in the town did and challenged the mayor on it. And in fact, it was in the talk I did at the town hall the other day, that the crowd challenged him and said, look, what's going on with these planters? You say there's no restrictions happening in Glastonbury, but, you know, those planters were used in Thetford and other areas to block roads. And they're made so you can slip a forklift truck underneath them and move them around, you know. They're just waiting to really be roadblocks. And, you know, the mayor fluffed around and said, oh, I didn't know how big they'd be. I thought, well, you must have seen a drawing, mate. You paid for them. But, yeah, he just denied all knowledge of it. But, yeah, it's a soft, smart city agenda. And it's going to not a very good place because, you know, with all that, with the 15-minute cities comes a lot more AI surveillance cameras. You know, you've got them tracking your movements, you know, your car, your number plate recognition, huge fines if you disobey. The whole thing is about control, and we know it's not about CO2, don't we? The thing is that they're making it all about CO2. And you know, this is the problem, is that again, at the Earth Summit, they created this lie and they're perpetuating it, and they won't stop. They won't stop. If you like, it's a global communism, and we call it communitarianism. And I don't know whether I've spoken to you about that before, but Maurice Strong, who set up the Earth Summit to actually bring in Agenda 21 in 1992, he was a great fan of China, massive fan. He was friends with Chairman Mao. His cousin lived with Chairman Mao, was his lover. And when he got done for the oil for food scandal, he went and lived out there. Because he was going to be put in jail in the United States for getting involved in the oil for food scandal with Adnan Khashoggi. So he lived out there and he ended his days there. And he absolutely loved the Chinese system. And he was, you know, he was a communist. He was a self-confessed communist. So this whole agenda is really about global control under that kind of system. And they've done it all in the name of saving the planet. It's so clever.
Now there's a woman on a mission. So yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? I think what we're seeing in Glastonbury, and in fact, it's very similar to what I saw in Bath a couple of months ago in January, Martin, is that these implications of these policies, as I was saying, it takes a while for them to trickle out. But once people realise what's going on, they're stuffing Glastonbury Town Council there. There are hundreds of them wanting to know what's going on. If they'd have implemented this maybe a year ago, they may have just, no one would probably have batted an eyelid and say, oh, this is really good for the planet. Now, there seems to be a head of steam of people out there who are saying, no, we're not having this.
Well, these kind of changes have always been controversial. In Leinster, where I'm sitting now, there's a town square, Corn Square, and it should have been pedestrianised years ago. It's only a small square. There's no particular reason to have cars parked there, but it was blocked by a laundrette, which is in there, and they knew that if it was pedestrianised, they'd go out of business. So they lobbied very, very hard, and it's still not been pedestrianised. Other cities like Gloucester, the central part of the city has been pedestrianised. Lots of businesses there complained about it because they were forced out. Businesses.
Okay, but what we're talking about isn't just pedestrianisation, is it? It's just pedestrianisation of residential areas too.
I'm just saying that these kind of changes are bound to be controversial because somebody's toes are always trodden on, and maybe it's not a very good idea in the first place. I mean, what sounds like happened in Glastonbury is the guy in charge didn't know what he was doing. Now, there's a big step from that sort of argument to discussions about global communism run by Maurice Strong, the great capitalist communist. The Chinese and the West are on a collision course at the moment. So the idea that this has all been some plan cooked up by the World Economic Forum,
Martin,
of the Chinese
whether you call it silly. Whether you call it communist or fascist, it's definitely not democracy. It's top down, isn't it?
Well, top down is sometimes you have to have a bit of top down, Tony. Everything doesn't get organised from the bottom up. the sewage system that takes away all of the poo every day, that isn't run by a committee.
You're talking about poo for some reason as an example, which is actually dragging the conversation into the gutter. But actually, I mean, the thing is, what's happening now is a hidden agenda. It's not, people have not been elected. When they were elected to sort out the sewage system, they did it all openly. And they did it actually before privatisation in public boards that you could go along and just watch what they were doing.
In actual fact, the system is broken because it's been privatised.
The honesty in which the sewage system was put together is completely gone. What's happening is there's whole layers of hidden agendas and a tremendous amount of chutzpah as to the what the real. It's a big lie. It's another big lie, isn't it?
Let's talk about the water companies. Because the water companies aren't communist at all. They used to be owned by the government. They used to be publicly owned. And therefore, they could follow public directives to what they should do. The privatisation is what's led to sewage being pumped into our rivers and onto our beaches. And it's not communism that's caused that, is it? It's the so-called free
market. As I said, I think it's top-down fascism, actually.
What you're doing is some things have to be top down, not everything, obviously. I mean, the principle used to be of subsidiarity. That means that decisions should be made at the appropriate level.
Yeah, and but honesty, Martin.
Can't be sorted out at local level.
This is really about honesty. It's not about fascist versus communism. It's about whether the people in power have got hidden agendas or not, and they quite clearly now have.
Well, I think we were talking earlier in the show about how politicians have to raise money in order to be in politics. They need resources. And who provides those resources? Well, the people with money. And then they've got their demands, haven't they? Now, we're trying, obviously, to try and get better people into politics, people who are honest and not dishonest and so on and so forth. But there was an awful lot of what I thought was airy-fairy stuff there. It isn't a communist plot. We need socialist change all over the world. We really need it. We need land reform. We need welfare rights. We need public ownership. And that, is the road to communism. But I mean, it's not what the World Economic Forum are after. They want to privatise everything.
I think maybe what Sandy's picked up there is a bit of right-wing spin. Certainly we need to have a mixed economy, and most importantly we need to have openness. And one of the reasons I think that so much has been gotten away with is because of the pathetic slackness of the mass media in really investigating this. Certainly when I was growing up in the 1970s and 80s, there was a tremendous amount of investigative journalism going on, hardly anything now. But just to wind up our little look at climate, in honour, I suppose, of Sandy and her work, is the from a couple of weeks ago, I was going to use it and I didn't. This is Tucker Carlson on Rupert Murdoch's Fox News talking about what he sees. And maybe he's the sort of guy that might say, oh, this is all a communist plot. Who knows? But anyway, he's done quite a good job, I think, in stringing together what is effectively a decades-long climate hoax.
In 2008, the Associated Press reported that according to a top NASA scientist, in 5 to 10 years, the Arctic will be free of sea ice in the summer. That didn't happen, but of course no one was ever held to account for bad predictions, so this kept going. John Kerry, now our climate czar, cited that very same science in 2009. Watch.
You have sea ice, which is melting at a rate that the Arctic Ocean now increasingly is exposed. In 5 years, scientists predict we will have the first ice-free Arctic summer.
What's hilarious is this is a guy who's never had a job. He's only been in politics. He's never done one useful thing. He's not a scientist. He's never done research. He's actually not an expert, but because he's way more aggressive than you are, and because he has access to the media, which amplify his claims, he poses as one. Now, what's strange about the prediction you just heard is that John Kerry's prediction contradicts Barack Obama's famous climate prediction from a year earlier. You probably remember this.
Because if we are willing to work for it and fight for it and believe in it,
then I am absolutely certain that generations from now, we will be able to look back and tell our children that this was the moment when we began to provide care for the sick and good jobs to the jobless. This was the moment when the rise of the oceans began to slow and our planet began to heal.
Sad to watch that, all the cheering people, they seem so sincere. He's going to save the world. He can control the weather. He's Jesus. But in fact, the global healing Obama promised at the beginning of his first term never came, and neither did the global destruction. Here, by the way, is Neil deGrasse Tyson, another great predictor of things, saying that by 2014, the Statue of Liberty will soon be underwater.
You know what I tell people? This wakes them into here in the New York metropolitan area. I say, you know, if we lose the ice caps, you know how high the water will be? I say, oh, maybe a couple of feet. No, it would come up to the Statue of Liberty's elbow, the one that's holding the Declaration of Independence. That's where the water line will be.
That man's a scientist. And of course, climate does change. It has always changed. In fact, the landscape we live in now is formed by climate change. The glaciers are a product of climate change. The climate is changing now. It never stops changing. That is a process that we didn't cause and that we can't control to any great degree. We will never be able to control. And there are upsides to it and downsides to it. By the way, if the Earth is indeed getting warmer, and it seems to be, well, then that will make more arable land in places like Canada and Northern Europe. So, like everything in this life, in the temporal world, it's a mixed blessing. But you only hear the downsides, which tells you a lot. It tells you this is not science, it's manipulation. These aren't reports from the experts. These are threats. Here's Joe Biden.
That's what climate change is about. It is literally, not figuratively, a clear and present danger. The latest climate report, nothing less than, quote, code red for humanity. Let me say it again. Code red for humanity.
Code red for humanity.
Yeah, so that's Tucker Carlson's take on it. Martin, overall, you've always saying you're a bit agnostic about the whole climate business. And I noticed I was chatting with some activists in Bristol the other day who were saying that they're actually having quite a lot of problems with Extinction Rebellion, that the support for them amongst volunteers and activists is starting to fall away. They're going to try and have a big get-together this spring in London and summer to, you know, sort of galvanise support behind them. But there's quite a few people who are thinking, well, actually, do we really want to be involved in this campaign? So what's your thought? Are you still as agnostic as you always were?
Well, I listened to the debate. I know also that the Russians are developing new icebreaker ships because they want to create a sea lane along the north coast of Russia because of the withdrawal of Arctic ice, and that they are all of the oil companies and all the countries around the Arctic are thinking of trying to get their bases where they need them to be and all the rest of it to try and get access to the resources in the Arctic, which will become available as the ice recedes. Now, if people are making plans like that with lots of money involved, it's likely that what they are predicting is actually going to happen. Now, as Tucker Carlson pointed out, maybe there is going to be warming. Maybe there is going to be removal. Ice caps are going to go down, but it won't be a problem because we've always managed and we will manage. I think we're one of the things Joe Biden didn't mention there is that the scientists have put the nuclear destruction clock at 30 seconds to midnight. That's really, really what we need to be focusing on. And of course, that's what we're not focusing on because we're focusing on other things like climate change when we should be thinking about nuclear war, financial collapse, civil conflict. And of course, we need to save the environment and look after it, but that isn't just climate change. There's all sorts of other things: soil loss, pollution, organophosphate chemicals.
Yeah. So, do you think there's going to be? I mean, Sandy there is really talking about the kind of pushback as people turn up at the local authorities. And I do wonder, I mean, one of the things she says to me, and obviously I'll put the longer interview with her up on our show page later at this week, climatechange.org.uk. There has been, a deliberate kind of, isn't it what Andrew Bridgen says, is willful ignorance, that the people who are in charge, so-called, you know, elected councillors or MPs or civil servants or whatever, whoever it happens to be, they're not just not interested in getting to grips with this. They're quite happy to turn up and take their wages, but they're not really looking into the implications of the things that they're implementing. I know you talked years ago about, in fact, you regularly bring it up about Aubrey Mayer and this whole idea of a kind of climate market, you know, as a carbon market. So it's getting that sorted out, which anyone, I think most people around the world that take a look at what's going on with climate change, and I'm definitely not a climate denier. I think there are big changes going on in the climate, but I think a bit like the dangers of COVID, it's just been exaggerated, weaponized, etc. So where do you think, do you think it's kind of running out of steam, this whole zero carbon agenda?
Well, the fact is that the world is breaking into two big blocks at the moment, the Western-oriented bloc and the Chinese, Russian, Iranian-oriented bloc. Now, if we're going to have a global response to something like climate change or anything else, because there's loads of other things that probably need to dealt with on a global level, none of this is going to happen while we are at war, and we are at war. Putin is supposedly a war criminal, so we can't negotiate with him, and therefore there's no point discussing climate change or anything else with a war criminal, is there? And all that's going to happen is the war, and that's what's going to dominate the next decade, and climate change will be a minor feature of the war that we're all going to be put through.
Moving on to another story, and that is really very much kind of Easter related, or anyway, Ramadan related. And that is the 10th anniversary of the murder of Mohammed Salim in Birmingham 10 years ago. He was walking home from prayers at the mosque, and he was attacked by a guy called Pavlo Lapshin. Now, Pavlo Lapshin was a Ukrainian. Is a Ukrainian. He was brought over to the UK actually by the Foreign Office. And in fact, he had a reception in Ukraine with the British ambassador there. And then he was brought over to Birmingham, went on to murder Maz's father 10 years ago. Now, Martin, I mean, this is, it's one of those stories that you think it should be writ large all over the press. And of course, if Mohammed Salim was Jewish, you might well see that, because there seems to be much more attention on crimes against Jews than there is against crimes against Muslims. As David Miller has always been pointing out, maybe that's one of the reasons. He's the professor of SACT, of sociology at Bristol University, why it's not talked about so much. So what do you make of this? This seems like a whole history of relations between the British Foreign Office and Ukrainian Nazis.
Well, it goes back to the 1940s, when the Banderites were largely allowed out of, they escaped from the Ukraine to the West. Stepan Bandera went to Germany, where he ultimately was assassinated in Munich in 1959, I think. And they've been used by Western intelligence as a means to undermine first the Soviet Union and now the Russian Federation. And they've had links with them, and just as they've had links with Islamist extremists from Al-Qaeda, who were used in the war in Afghanistan. And so the Western intelligence services cultivate links with all of these kind of groups because they're all ultimately potentially useful to them.
OK, so as we crack on towards the end of part one, let's have a listen now to Maz Salim. That's Mohammed Salim's daughter, who I spoke to earlier this week. She was up at the National Education Union's conference in Leeds, I think, speaking to them about the death of her father, his murder. And of course, the complicity of the British government and the Foreign Office in all that. But anyway, when I spoke to her, she just came out with these amazing set of bombshells, one after the other, to do with this Ukrainian Nazi murdering her granddad 10 years ago. Let's have a listen now to Maz Salim on the murderer Pavlo Lapshin.
Pavlo shook the hands of the British ambassador before he came to the small East Birmingham. And where we live is a predominantly Muslim area. And for him to come to a Muslim area and to get a work placement there, and knowing his neo-Nazi history in Ukraine, where he's making open plan bombs in the forest, where he actually blew up his, he was making a chemical bomb in his flat, and he blew that up as well. So there was a long history of him being a neo-Nazi and being a big fan of Dynamo Kiev. And, you know, they found folders on his laptop, ethnic cleansing folders. He was a big fan of Timothy McVeigh. He also looked at, the New Zealand terrorist who murdered 51 Muslims in 51 Muslims. He had Pavlo Lapshin's name etched on his gun when he did that murder, because he had all the people he looked up to. So that's how far this type of hate goes, because the media never portrayed, they always portray Muslims in a biased fashion, and these attacks are never highlighted. So yeah, we definitely do believe there was more than one person who attacked him that night, and we had to push the police to investigate this properly, because they were going to go with a robbery. You know, always a robbery. But my dad doesn't carry anything in his pockets. So they had all these motives. But the motive of an Islamophobic terrorist attack was never their option. We had to push the police to investigate this properly. And the amount of the amount of rubbish they gave us was ridiculous. And how they treated us at the beginning, they were like, "We're going to tell you what this is." And we said, "No, we're going to tell you what this is." Yeah. You know, they stormed into our house like, you know, we were uneducated and we can't speak English. Well, we're all educated, we're all graduates. We know how the British police force are known to be racist. And so we had to challenge them and fight ourselves. And we control the media. We had to get the media to come because they were pushing a different narrative.
Yeah, well, there is a bit of a problem, it seems, with the police. With the Nicola Bulley case a couple of months ago, the police were saying, "Oh, we just think she fell into the water and drowned." Well,
yeah,
the family didn't believe that. And in fact, what started to happen was lots of the neighbours and people who lived in the village were having to do their own investigations for the Lancaster police. But anyway, you said something very interesting there, something about the ambassador. Now, surely someone who's just come over as a migrant from Ukraine is not going to be shaking the hands of the British ambassador. I mean, that sounds absurd.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why we always have believed there's been a lot more to it, because, we had the London riots not so long before. And maybe, you know, I don't know. I've always kind of thought this could have been a state organized attack or a colluded attack, because it's like, how can we allow Nazis in the country without checking them under the counter-terrorism bill, which they do with Muslims, or the prevent, which criminalizes ordinary Muslims. How come he wasn't checked? How come he was allowed to come here on a work placement and live in a Muslim area and right behind, like not far from where we lived? And the fact that he not only murdered my father, like he butchered my father in the streets, and then he won a 3-month bombing campaign in Warsaw, Wolverhampton and Tipton and put bombs outside 3 mosques, and this was one of the biggest acts of terrorism towards Muslims in the UK. And yet today I've had to fight to get it into the media. When I spoke to a major British broadcasting house, I had to argue with them to give the right information about my father's murder, and all they kept doing, you know, those typical negative stereotypes, was he like an Al-Qaeda type of attack? No, it was a neo-Nazi terrorist attack. And they always get the facts and the information incorrect, and whenever my father's death is mentioned in the media, it's never with the correct information. It was an act of terrorism, and they should call it a far right attack. Now, it's a far right terrorist attack.
Yeah.
Let's get the word terrorist in there.
You've just said something else. It's almost like every answer you're giving me, Maz, there's another bombshell in it. You saying he was committing other terrorist attacks? Was that before he attacked your father?
Yeah, in Ukraine, there was a Ukrainian journalist who contacted me, who was actually giving me some information. And, you know, it's from a place called Dnipritov. I don't know if I pronounced that correctly, but he basically was making open plan bombs in the forest. He also, his neighbors said he was making some chemical experiment. He's a very, very clever PhD student. And also, Tony, I need to tell you, while he has been in prison in the UK, because he's been moved from Belmarsh to another prison, and they don't always keep us informed, so I have to push for them to know. He basically tried to make a chemical bomb in the prison, and he tried to blow up his prison cell, which they failed to highlight in the media. And I've had to find this information out from someone in that prison who gave me this information discreetly, and then I've had to contact the victim support and then get them to get their seniors to contact me, and then I had to push that story into the media.
Now, did you manage to figure out what was his motive? I mean, obviously, the guy is neo-Nazi, but can we get inside the head of this guy? I know it's not a very nice thing for you to have to do, but to think, what is the motive there? What is actually driving him? Because he does sound like some sort of, actually, psychologically deranged maniac, as you've said, a neo-Nazi. But what drives these people?
Well, he in his police interview, he said he wanted to create a race war. But this is like in a country that you know nothing about. So, you know, the fact that, you know, the planning that must have gone in his head, he's a very clever student. He was very he's done well in all his studies. That's why he apparently got this work placement. So his mind, he obviously has a lot of hatred towards Muslims. This is why he targeted Muslims in Birmingham. I mean, why he chose Birmingham in particularly is like, you know, and I was, you know, I've been looking at this for the past 10 years, and I know the far right here work with the far right in Europe. So, you know, we had the Football Lads Alliance here, which did a 10,000 mobilization a few years ago here in the city in London. And that was very scary. But it was all beefy white men marching, and they have a lot of contact with Nazis in Europe. Mm. So we know this could have been, they could have all been working together, because how would they know? How would he know these three mosques, these locations? Why did he choose those mosques in particularly? How did he know his way round Birmingham?
Yeah,
you know, he could not have done this by himself. No, there's a lot of planning gone into this.
I mean,
I'm sure he's working with Nazis in this country.
Well, it does sound as if we've got a bunch of Nazis in the Foreign Office, Martin. This guy being brought over, almost specifically, it seems, to do these terrorist attacks. He then was managing to do them with impunity in Birmingham of some sort. And then when the police killed Maz's, when Pavlo Lapshin, when he killed Maz's father, the police are saying, oh, it was just a robbery, you know. So it looks as if we've got a quite a serious Nazi problem within our Foreign Office and our police.
Well, that's all very disturbing, what I've just been hearing. But of course, as I said before the clip, relationships between the intelligence services and the neo-Nazis in the Ukraine go back to the 1940s. And their relationship with Islamist extremists go back to the creation of Al-Qaeda in the 1980s and the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, who were largely based in Manchester, for example.
Well, we've got loads of these Ukrainians living over here now, many of whom may be Nazis. We've also had a rather controversial decision by MI5 not to even bother really looking into many of the people who were out there fighting for al-Nusra Front and Al-Qaeda, etc., in Syria, haven't we?
Well, we've got the Shamima Begin case where they're refusing to let her come back to Britain. But as you know, she was recruited by a Canadian intelligence officer who was working for Canadian intelligence. So the Western intelligence services have been deeply involved in all sorts of terroristic activities around the world and also in Europe, you know, Gladio in Italy, etc. I don't think he was put up to this. I think he's obviously a very convinced neo-Nazi militant, and he probably did all this with other Nazi help, I would imagine. And I think the relationship with the British is fascinating, because they have actually encouraged these people. The Azov Battalion, who are neo-Nazis, have been trained by the British Army. They have been trained by the British Army. They shouldn't have been trained by the British Army, but they were. Our taxes were used to train them. And of course, these paramilitary formations within the Ukrainian National Guard are separate from the main command structure. They have their own command structure. They're like the Ulster Defence Association. You know, they are militants, but they've been given military training by our people. And that's because the City of London and the deep state in the US and the Israelis, they want a war with Russia. So that, I think what's happened here is he's been brought over here because he's part of those networks and been protected, but he's actually just gone on a little freelance spree. And of course, what they've tried to do is cover up all the connections, because of course it's embarrassing for them that somebody like that, that has been obviously under their protection, goes and does stuff like this, which basically shows what they are. But they're like that in the Ukraine as well, and we carry on supporting them, which is why
I'm not
having it.
Is Sandy Adams talking about the zero carbon agenda, Agenda 2030, and also with Maz Salim there talking about the secret armies, effectively these kind of terror gangs, they're basically, they are death squads, and organised death squads. And then the idea is that the authorities and the media say it's a lone wolf and there's no proper investigation. And also, maybe finally on this one, Martin, interesting that there is quite obviously an ideological connection between Pablo Lapshin and the shooter in Christchurch. He's thinking, he's looking very carefully around the world, seeing all these various Islamophobic attacks. And he's writing this guy's name as his hero on the gun that he's using to kill whatever it was. I think it was 55 Muslims in Christchurch a couple of years ago.
I think the issue with all of these neo-Nazi lone wolf attacks is, are they lone wolves?
Yeah,
and the same is true of so-called Islamist attacks. What's the actual agenda here? And I think that there are at the margin people who are acting alone or without wide support. But there's also the deliberate creation of terrorist networks by NATO intelligence services in order to steer public opinion in certain kinds of directions.
Well, it's interesting.
In Norway, for example, did he act alone? And of course, it's in the interest of the authorities to say, yes, oh, this is just one crazy person. Because if you look deeper into it, you'll see that intelligence services are probably behind all of it.
Yeah, and he was a Freemason. He wasn't acting alone. I mean, you know, quite clearly he's got secret contacts through Freemasonry where he was getting advice about guns and arms and this sort of thing. So it looks as if the Freemasons may be immune to prosecution, and we should put an end to that, perhaps. Anyway, a couple of pieces before the musical break. One based, first of all, based on the... on Sandy Adams and her look at zero carbon, because people are doing stuff about this. There's a group over in the Forest of Dean, and this I recorded a couple of weeks ago, and it's this we're going to hear now about the Rewilding Project, because they've been evicted they're being evicted in the process of it from the New Forest, and they've been running a project there for the Forestry Commission, what it is called now Forest England. And a couple of weeks ago, I spoke to a chap called Scott Bain over there about what they're really doing. You know, they're basically rewilding humans. That's what they call it. Not rewilding, putting wolves back into the forest so your kids can get eaten by them as they go for a walk. But rewilding humans, that is to say, reskilling people with the skills we need for basic survival.
The dependency on people's skills and crafts and way of life is not so needed, but it's feel like it's coming around full circle. You know, it's kind of the old skills for new jobs coming back. And part of that was also setting up a project called New Leaf underneath the umbrella or underneath the canopy of Rewild Project. And New Leaf was social forestry as well, so we were the only ones in Forest of Dean that was actively coppicing land and restoring coppicing. But it was almost a bit of a token gesture by Forestry England, along with a 5-year funding that we were tied in, and we ran five contracts through that, and we were the most successful partner in sort of, there's like 32 different organisations running projects within the Forest of Dean, which were supposed to be based, tied into the heritage and the, you know, the past heritage and the potential future heritage. And the sheds that we basically have eco-refurbed over the last sort of 6-7 years. We were got given permission, and then we were on license. Basically, every 12 months we have to apply for the license. And so initially it seemed fine, and then we thought that we had some security for sort of 5 years with the funding, which ended last March. So it's like a year now since it ended.
22.
Yeah, so the funding basically allowed us to refurb the sheds, and I mean, it's probably about 80 grand's worth of funding that's gone into refurbing it. And Forest England's initial solution to deal with it was to smash it down, basically, because it was in a really, like, yeah, it's in a really bad state. And I mean, we could talk about land banking as well, and the sort of tactic of Forest England, or Forest Commission generally, or just that approach of land injustice, where, you know, the big powers hold on to land or hold on to property until it becomes into a state of disrepair, and then that gives them the reason to smash it down or change planning from, you know, commercial / residential. So a lot of the reasons why we're in dispute as well is because we started sticking our head above the parapet and looking at a abandoned farm that's part of probably about, it's part of the public estate, forest estate, which they call it, public forest estate. So Forest England, like the other side of Colford, there was a farm, Bracelands, that's been empty for 10 years that they've basically been running to the ground because it's got commercial and residential on it. And we've been saying, oh, we want to turn this into a traditional craft centre and also practice regen ag. We want to sort of provide low impact dwellings and training, basically getting people on the land. And our essential sort of remit and approach is to create spaces of learning, and then people come to learn these, you know, skills.
Well, it seems a bit of a them and us agenda has crept into the Forestry Commission, according to Scott Bain there. And I'll put a full version of that interview up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. But what they are doing is they are staying put. You know, they're being told by the Forestry England that they've got to leave, but they're not. They're saying, look, we're happy to carry on here, and if you want to get rid of us, you're going to have to do it by force. And one of the reasons that the Forestry England, Martin, seem to have turned on these people is because they're saying you shouldn't be leaving land just lying around derelict. I mean, we can understand greedy property developers land banking it in the cities, but this is a big estate that you've got management of here out in the countryside. Everyone can see what you're doing, and we're not having it. You know, that this, they're talking about this derelict farm that's been left for 10 years. And just for, it seems anyway, just for bringing this up as an issue, they're being told by their landlords at Forestry England, then they've got, we're going to hoof you out now. How dare you speak against the creed?
Well, I mean, it's the first I've heard of this. It sounds like, you know, a typical political struggle with different agendas on different sides. You're always going to be in a difficult position if you are funded by Forestry England and you don't want to, and you don't actually agree with their policy, because they'll say, well, we're funding you, so you're not in a position to disagree with our policy.
Isn't this the way things work nowadays, is you've got to constantly go back and bid again and again and again for funding or for a contract? The idea is there's no sense of permanency. And I think, you know, we're living in a world now where even public bodies have gotten into this very commercial kind of oil company attitude where you want to be able to hire and fire at will.
Well, that may be so. And the way in which grants are distributed is going to depend upon what the rules are for those grants, and if you get some of them, that's fine, but then of course you're dependent on that money, aren't you? It's you know, fine, we're coming back to what we were saying earlier with that Nicola Sturgeon, and money is the key to doing anything. If you're going to do anything politically, you're going to need some resources. Where are you going to get those resources from? There are possible solutions. You can have membership organisations where people pay subscriptions. You can do fundraising events, or you can apply for money from public bodies. You know, or you can rob banks, as used to happen in Ireland. But you've got to have resources.
Well, that doesn't happen anymore, because the people that need to rob the banks or want to rob the banks already own them.
Well, that's right. I mean, that kind of bank robbery is, you know, if you want to rob a bank, you have got to own it, because that's the way to steal it, isn't it? Far more effective.
Yeah, anyway, look, let's move on. I mean, that is called the Rewild Project. You'll find them online at therewildproject.com, and that's Scott Bain. Very best of luck with them, with their little battle that they're having with the Forestry Commission in the Forest of Dean. And the Forest of Dean is a fairly, you know, I'm hoping anyway that they will at least get a bit of traction with the locals, getting local support around there. But our final item before the break is one I've been holding back for a couple of weeks. It's, I think, absolutely fascinating, Martin. It's the British Gladio, and it never was needed in the Second World War. But what they did is they were formed in 1940, right at the beginning of the war, worried that the Nazis were going to invade Britain, and they set up a whole network around the country of these kind of sabotage camps where they would use to base sabotage of the occupying forces. And I guess, is it true to say that this happens in most wars, that when you're taking territory, people, I mean, for example, going on now, over in Ukraine, as the Russians advance, then they find Ukrainian saboteurs popping up behind enemy lines.
Well, it's been an issue going back to the 19th century. What they used to call franc-tireurs, which is basically civilians taking pot shots at military formations.
Well, these aren't civilians. These are trained soldiers
that are not
civilians.
So
let's have a listen now to the, well, they're called CART, Coles Hill Auxiliary Research Trust, and they're kind of affiliated with the National Trust, who own most of Coles Hill. It's this little village near Swindon. And it's a kind of mad tale, because I only just accidentally came across this little hut that was in the woods somewhere. I thought, what's that, you know? And this is, in the hut, there was a whole bunch of display boards about the way that this little village had been used, innocuous little place, as the headquarters for this national army, the British Gladio. So let's have a listen now to the Stay Behinds, CART, the Coles Hill Auxiliary Research Trust, and John Wareham and Roger Green.
The name's John Wareham. I'm just a volunteer with the Coles Hill Auxiliary Research Team. Been with them since 2016. So I just help out with a display that I've got and go around the local fetes and villages and try and introduce people to what these boys did.
And I'm Roger Green. I'm a volunteer with the National Trust, but also a volunteer with the Coles Hill Auxiliary Research Team as well. And I take school children round and explain what happened here during the war. We also have open days as well. We take more people round.
Now, your website is www.staybehinds.com. So what is the Stay Behind?
Stay Behind is because that's what they did. These chaps who were trained here, they stayed behind and waited for the enemy to appear or invade. They hid. Then when they passed over, they popped up and started blowing things up, such as the fuel dumps. If you haven't got fuel, you can't advance.
So they were kind of guerrilla saboteurs?
Very much so, very much so. It's the first time a resistance group, if you like, was set up before an invasion. Normally, the resistance groups are set up after an invasion.
So do you want to just say something about what the timing in the war? Because the war started in 1939.
After Dunkirk, it was realised then that we were next, and Hitler had already got organised an invasion, which was called... What was it called? Sea Lion, that's it, yeah. Operation Sea Lion, yeah. And that's when they realised that, you know, we're next. So let's get something in operation so that we can at least delay them, so that our troops, who were a bit of a disarray by then, could get organised, ready to defend properly. But these guys, they were told, you know, if you come across a group of the enemy, don't take them on, back off, take them on another day, you know, because they'd be outnumbered.
Why are we in Coles Hill? I mean, this is a tiny little village. No one would even notice. It's about 20 minutes from Swindon.
You said it.
Coles Hill had a big house here, which it was set in a considerable amount of land, and it was ideal. It was sort of central, so everybody from the south coast could come here, be trained, and then sent back to their units. Here was an ideal base for all of the trainers to come from all over the world.
Well, yeah, but it was an invisible base. I mean, you know, this is the sort of thing you wouldn't even spot if you were to drive through it, walk through it, or from the air.
No, indeed. And these boys were to keep secret for 50 years. So this whole base was secret for 50 years.
So what was actually here, hidden away?
It was just the headquarters, and people came here for training. So we had over 3,000 people came here for training. And they would come for a long weekend. So this is when the big house was here, and they had an operational base, as they call it, a bunker, underground bunker, that showed them how to operate one, how to make one, how to live in one. And they also went under training, how to make explosives, how to blow things up, you know, how to kill people. They were very efficient. And some of these guys, they got a bit frustrated because they weren't fighting, and they joined things like the SAS. And we know of six that joined the SAS. They were flown behind enemy lines into France, and unfortunately they were caught, and they were inoculated with cyanide. And unfortunately, if we had been invaded, the same kind of result would have happened here. These guys, because they were civilians, they weren't in the military at all. They were trained by the military, but they were civilians. They would be people like farmers, gamekeepers, foresters, people who could live off the land, basically. Yeah, and they were highly trained. Yeah,
they were trained in these sorts of survival skills.
Indeed, yeah, yeah. But of course, a lot of these guys, like farmers, they knew how to live off the land. But if we had been invaded, the survival rate was supposed to be about 2 weeks before they were caught and captured. But at the end of the war, they got a letter saying, thank you very much, don't say anything. Because it was deemed, if you like, ungentlemanly conduct, you know, or ungentlemanly warfare.
You've got a nice little display here. You were saying you're taking around local villages and things.
Yes.
Actually, quite a lot to look at. You've got railway lines that look like it's got a little bit of Semtex stuck on the line to blow it to bits.
Most of this stuff is homemade. I've put it together as
it's not real Semtex then.
No. There was a story about somebody who used to go around with marzipan, coloured as the Noble 808, but unfortunately the drug dog could sniff it out, and the proper explosive smells like marzipan. So there was a bit of a hoo-ha about that, and he had to use plasticine in the end. But no, this is just purely chip wrapper. I mean, the paper on it is actually the paper that you would have your fish and chips wrapped up in. The cardboard boxes there were made up with the cardboard carrier bags that you carry your chips home in. All that sort of thing. Everything's just Blue Peter stuff.
Quite a lot of guns here. Are they all British guns?
There's a Martini rifle at the top, which they would have used as a sniper rifle. There's a Thompson machine gun, which would have been sent over from America. That was under the sort of auspices of helping out the English, but it basically went to us first. The army didn't get a look in until we'd been supplied. There's also an MP40 there, which, of course, is a German weapon. But these boys would have been trained with a German weapon, because if they needed to, they knew how to use them. And if the Germans had landed, they could have used their weapons as well as ours. So they were trained in all sorts of things: unarmed combat, rifles, explosives, surveillance. Anything that was needed was trained. And some of these boys were chosen because of what they were good at. Poachers, gamekeepers, but a baker who worked from 2 o'clock in the morning, he could walk around at night. He knew where he was going.
So we're in Coles Hill, but you've also got a sign here saying it's also Purbeck's best kept secret, so it doesn't sound like this was the only place.
No. Once you get involved with one little thing, it tends to spread like a branches of a tree, and you end up...
What has your group been doing here today?
We've started doing a 360-degree camera system, so that these OBs, if we find the operational base and it's intact, we can put a camera in it, and then you, as a general public, can look around it without actually endangering yourself.
Okay, so you've got a little diagram here of what looks like a kind of little office barracks building of some sort under the ground. So how big were these?
You're looking at about 21 metres, something like that.
All told, yeah.
21 metres in length, maybe 4 metres in width, and 3 or 4 metres in height, and probably buried about two feet just under the metre underground.
So there may be some of those in Coles Hill here and other villages?
We've got a mock-up which the Coles Hill estate have created. We do have training bunkers here that were from the wartime. There are loads of them out there, and we haven't found no more than half of them at the moment.
So if someone thinks that they might, I mean, what do they look like from the top? Is it just a kind of a hatch or a metal cover over the top of it, a wooden cover or what?
Some of them have been discovered because children have found a piece of wire and pulled it and the hatch have popped up. Others, you'll get a sort of sinkage in the ground, and that's the roof collapsing because after 70 to 80 years, that roof, which is steel, is starting to rot out. You might find an odd manhole somewhere, or maybe even a bit of drainage pipe that you think, well, what's that for? Because it's nothing. But it could have been the vent pipes for these things.
We know also that the radio communications was a very important part of all of this. It's no point having an auxiliary unit, which these were, without it being able to communicate with others.
Well, there was a special duties branch, but one didn't know the other, in actual fact.
That was sensible, wasn't it?
Yeah,
as we know with the resistance and the Mackies on the continent, they had to operate in small cells so that they couldn't betray the others.
And one cell didn't know the next cell. Yeah, obviously, if one had been caught, they didn't want them to spread the news about the other.
How did they communicate?
Well, if we'd been invaded, they wouldn't communicate with each other. The radios mainly were to find out what was happening out there, the invasion forces. So they could leave messages in these dead letterboxes for somebody to pick up and then transmit back to HQ, in effect, eventually. So they knew where all the troops were and what troops were around.
So this is like modern spycraft, isn't it, the dead letterbox?
Yeah. And we've got some dummies here. Yeah, we've got one hidden in a bolt that goes into a fence post.
Sounds like quite a lot of fun in Coles Hill.
Oh, yeah.
You could almost set, you know, children, and maybe adult children as well, to go and see if they can find whereabouts these people
are.
We
do. We have that. We have something called Secrets and Spies for the children, and they come here and they learn all about it. And one of the things they do is hunt for these messages. So the one in the gatepost, then they'll find one in probably a brick, another one in a tennis ball, and it passes them round, and then finish up at the special duties base in the chicken hut, where they go and see what this secret radio station looked like.
Now, you're holding in your hand a bolt. Looks like it's been taken out of a car, a lorry, or something.
Yep. Something that's dropped out down on the road or come out of a gatepost. But the end of it does unscrew. Now, of course, they would have used a left-hand thread, because if you try and unscrew something normally, it would just tighten on the left-hand thread.
Right.
So that would be partly the secret.
Actually, the head of the bolt, I mean, it comes off. The head of the bolt comes off.
Indeed, yeah. And the message inside. The same with a telegraph pole. You might have a, if you've noticed on the telegraph pole, there's usually a label or something like that, but it might come out and you've got a hidden message. And of course, if it's a triangle, if the top of it is flat, the message is in there. And if the top of it is pointed, the message isn't.
But what about radio communications? No, you're saying what, if there was an invasion, that would have to all stop?
Well, I think some of it would still go on. If they're being listened to, they might give false information, which I think they did do. They used those radios to give false information for D-Day. There's very little known about this special duties branch, actually.
You're still finding out things, aren't you? So, anyway, so if people are interested either in coming down to Coles Hill or coming along to one of your exhibitions or whatever, how do they follow it?
Well, they can either go to the website, which is www.staybehinds.com, which gives them a wealth of information. I can guarantee once you get on there, you'll be there for a fortnight. You can actually identify if you have relations who might have been involved on that as a database. Also, at Coles Hill, we open once a month between April and October in the afternoon, Sunday afternoon, second Sunday of the month, the exception being the first one, because of Easter, we're opening on April the 16th. People are more than welcome to come along, and we'll take them for a little tour around the replica operational base.
So, but the thing is, the British weren't the only to have these stay-behind units, were they? And whenever there's a war, there is an attempt to do this. As the front advances, the other side, including the Germans, maybe even in Ukraine now.
Yeah, yeah. I think, yeah, there were others. I believe there were some in Germany as well. But this is documented more. probably because we, you know, are finding out about it, you know, and investigating more.
Why so much secrecy?
Who knows, you know. But I think during the war...
And even the Cold War, maybe these tactics are still being used. That's what I'm thinking.
Well, once they signed the Official Secrets Act, it's forever, in actual fact. But about 10, 11 years ago, we actually got a letter from the government to say these guys can now talk about it officially.
Okay.
Yeah.
So maybe some of the tradecraft has moved on and they don't, you know, mind people discussing it. Can you just, I mean, I don't know if you're doing these exhibitions elsewhere. How can people come along and see some of this stuff and talk to you guys?
I'm hoping to get over to the Isle of Wight this year. I'm waiting to see whether they're going to have me, whether they've got space for me. But normally I get invited to local fetes and fairs on the Purbex. There's one coming up at Chickerell as well near Weymouth. But my diary is sort of filled up in April usually with people screaming at me saying, can you come along?
Can you say something about this truck? Because we're looking at it. It's a little a trailer that you tow behind your car.
Mm, yeah.
But only half of it is used. You took me around the back and showed me that there's a little peephole. You can look in the back of this and there's something else going on.
Yes, it's my little homage to the SD section. The van is...
Which is what?
Which is the special radio operators. The whole van is made up to look like a chicken hutch for that reason. Around the back, I've made up a little homage to them by having a visual chickens in the visual hutch. But if you click the switch that's there the other way, it shows the man in the other end behind a hidden wall.
So the idea is that you might peep in to see, to check it was a real chicken hutch, and you'll see all the chickens, but what you don't realise is there's a little partition at the end where there's someone actually on
secret
communicating.
Wall. Yep, secret wall.
Okay, just if you could just tell us again how people can follow this.
If you're at a local fair in the Purbex, you're probably going to see me. I'm always there. I'm at Harman's Cross, August bank holiday usually. And if you want to, you can look up on my website, the Creech Barrow 7, and you can have a look at my stuff on there.
The Creech, C-R-E-E-C-H, Barrow, B-A-R-R-O-W, 7, the letters, S-E-V-E-N, .simdif, S-I-M-D-I-F .com.
Yep.
Okay, thanks very much.
That's okay, it's a pleasure. Thank you.
So, John Wareham and Roger Green there from CART, C-A-R-T, Coles Hills Erie Research Trust. Fascinating little insight into a bit of wartime history. We'll be coming back in a minute and looking at, he'll be hearing from Tony Greenstein, talking about what's been going on in Israel and looking at Ursula and Emmanuel over in China.
We recall today the new commandment which Jesus gave his disciples on the night of his betrayal, that they were to love one another. This is how he prepares them and us for what is about to happen to him, for the arrest, the trial, the judgment, and the cross.
Jesus said, "Now the Son of Man has been glorified, and God has been glorified in him. If God has been glorified in him, God will also glorify him in himself and will glorify him at once. Little children, I am with you only a little longer. You will look for me. And as I said to the Jews, so now I say to you, where I am going, you cannot come. I give you a new commandment, that you love one another. Just as I have loved you, you also should love one another. By this, everyone will know that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another."
It's only really in John's Gospel that Jesus talks about his inner life with God. When he does so in the verses we have just heard, I think he deliberately refers to himself as the Son of Man, as though to imply that all of us ordinary human beings are called to share in the life he already shares with the Father. God's love is eternal and without bounds or limits, and God is not remote or distant, he is not an oppressor. God is always turned towards us in love, waiting for our response. And as we follow the story of Jesus during the next few days, we pray for those who have their own crosses to bear, the sick, the injured, the troubled, all who are excluded and badly treated, prisoners, refugees, and those caught up in slavery. Lord Jesus, we praise you for your redeeming love. As we follow in the way of the cross, we acknowledge the debt that we owe. For ours is the sin you bear. Ours is the ransom you pay. Ours is the salvation you win. And though we can never be worthy of your love, make us always thankful and ready to bear each other's burdens. For your holy name's sake. Amen. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, for ever and ever. Amen.
I do know how I survive. Yes, I do know how.
1992. That is Mood Swings and Chrissy Hynde from 1992 with Spiritual High. Amazing the stuff that was coming out in the early 1990s. And yeah, I'm definitely going to be putting some more of those in our breaks in the months to come. Very powerful. And actually, of course, you know, I know one of the things I always love to do with this program is to reach out to the US. I mean, we've got some hideous creatures here in the UK and in the United States really trying to screw things up for the rest of the world. A lot of them linked very closely with the whole Zionist project. And so in a way, it's quite crucial that America and Britain share, you know, and of course, we you know, we so-called discovered America, too. You know, Bristol John Cabot and the journeys over there and the slave trade and all that sort of stuff. We've got a lot of links with the Americans. And so, you know, I'd like to think of a kind of positive alliance, really, between the British and the Americans to counter this hideous kind of thing, which it seems to be making trouble all around the world. And Martin, we're going to start, I think, by looking at the big news last weekend, which was a Russian blogger by the name of Vladan Talarsky, who apparently someone came to a cafe in St. Petersburg and gave him a model of himself, which was a sort of caricature, kind of comedy thing, which then blew him up and killed him.
Yeah, obviously I've been following this. The woman who brought it to the event had it confiscated on the door by the security because they said it, they thought it might be a bomb. She then went and sat in the thing and she mentioned in the discussion that she brought this statue for him, but it had been detained by the security. And he foolishly said, oh, well, just bring it over and I'll have a look at it. And that's how he got blown up. But the I think what the police in St. Petersburg are saying is that she didn't necessarily know that it was a bomb. So I don't know where the investigation's gone with this so far. I think the Russian authorities have suggested that it's probably the Ukrainians who've done this. Just they've definitely said it was the Ukrainians behind the assassination of Dugin's daughter some months ago. And of course, we've had all sorts of things like this going on for years. Zakachenko, who's the elected prime minister of the Donetsk Republic, he was blown up by a bomb in his office. And I want to put this to Rishi Sunak. Is this a legitimate political tactic, Rishi? Because we're funding it and we're doing it. We're blowing up individuals in Russia. Is that okay? Because if it is okay, then when the Russians do it to you, you won't be in a position to argue, will you?
Well, one of the points that you make, I mean, it's corroborated by some of the latest news on this in that although she's called the assassin who killed the Putin blogger, she herself was injured in the attack.
Yeah, well, that suggests that she's an unwilling accomplice, as it were.
Or else, someone has put this idea into her mind. And she has taken this, you know, so yeah, she's
so in
basically...
In other words, the police have got to look for somebody. Where did she get the statue from? How did she get hold of it? And this sort of thing. I mean, the bombing of the Kerch Bridge, that killed three civilians. And it was trumpeted in the Ukrainian press and in the West. Great, we've blown up the Kerch Bridge. But three civilians died. In fact, one of the bombs was in a truck that was being driven by somebody. He was one of the people who died. He didn't know he had a bomb in the truck. These are the tactics adopted by the SBU, the Ukrainian Secret Services, and no doubt their friends and allies in MI6, who live just around the corner from you, dear listener. They do stuff like this.
This is the sort of thing that Q might prepare, isn't it? This sort of, you know, clever little bomb device.
Well, of course, what it is they're losing the war, you know, Bakhmut or Artemyovsk, as it's called in Russian, is going to fall. They can't really get an offensive together. They're talking about it, but they haven't got the means. And so this kind of pinprick attack on a relatively minor person is all they've got. But it's pretty poor. You know, it is quite literally scraping the bottom of the barrel, engaging in this kind of low-level terrorism, because you can't win the war on the ground. And it just diverts people's attention from even bigger stories like the Nord Stream 2 pipeline being blown up by the Americans. I was reading in The Guardian this morning that the Swedish authorities have said it must have been a state behind this, and it couldn't have been the people in a yacht. But they're still not saying the obvious thing, which we, and nothing in the article in The Guardian mentioned that Seymour Hersh has already broken this story on the internet and Substack. And what his reputation is for breaking stories going back decades. And they just don't want to touch it with a barge pole because it's pretty obvious that they did indeed blow it up, which means that the whole of Europe is going to go into a depression. Millions of people are going to lose their jobs. And it's all the Americans who, and the Americans did that, no doubt with British approval.
The
people are going to have to wake up because they're going to, their living standards are going to be destroyed. Not by the Russians, but by the Americans, who are determined.
There is a story in the New York Times. Ukraine war plans have been leaked, and it prompts an investigation in the Pentagon. Classified documents detailing secret US and NATO plans have appeared on Twitter and Telegram. The building up of the Ukrainian military ahead of a planned offensive against Russia were posted this week on social media. A senior Biden administration official said the Pentagon is investigating who may have been behind the leak, which appeared on Twitter and Telegram, and it's widely available all over Russia. Military analysts said the documents have been modified in certain parts from their original format, overstating American estimates of Ukrainian war dead and understating estimates of Russian troops killed. So do you think that's true? They've actually been altered as well as leaked?
Well, I don't know is a simple answer to that. It doesn't surprise me that things get leaked because things do get leaked one way and another. And information does get out.
Well, it's very embarrassing if Americans are secretly sharing information about Ukrainian casualties, which are much higher than the ones they're talking about publicly. And so that
they've been lying about every aspect of this war from the very beginning. And they've even justified it by saying, yes, we are lying, but it's wartime and we're allowed to lie. But even if you are lying, it's a fairly poor strategy. And it has worked in terms of the ordinary population in the West who don't really pay attention and they're not really engaged with it. It's just at the edge of their attention span, as it were. But of course, in the world at large, where, you know, there are other forces at work, people like the Indian Army Intelligence Operation, they don't believe a word of what's being told about the Ukraine. I circulated some while ago, General Ravi Shankar, who's an Indian general, talking about what's going on in the Ukraine and comparing it with the wars they've had with Pakistan over the Kargil Pass, and the importance of artillery and the Russian mastery of artillery warfare, none of which appears in the West at all. We're just given an undying propaganda message about how Zelensky is a reincarnation of Churchill, and the Ukrainians are going to win. And if you say otherwise, you're a Putin lover. And there's just no realism about it. I mean,
well, Zelensky's saying this week that kicking Russia out of Crimea is still the plan. And there's also been a report actually, no, from the US pushing back against giving Ukraine a roadmap to NATO. Poland and the Baltic states want to offer Ukraine clearer statements on joining NATO, whereas the FT reported yesterday the US is pushing back against an effort by some of the European allies to provide Ukraine with a roadmap. Now, the Ukrainians are not going to be very happy to hear that, are they? Because the Americans are promising them the earth.
Talking about, doesn't it?
Sorry?
The current Ukrainian government may not be happy to hear that, but I bet you plenty of people in the East Ukraine who support their own political leadership are quite happy that they're not going to be allowed to join the NATO. So are the Russians. But of course, it's not clear what's going to happen. They've started all of this with what they basically planned to provoke the war, blow up the Nord Stream pipeline, therefore cutting the umbilical cord between German industry and Russian raw materials, which was the big threat to the Anglo-Zionist empire. So they've achieved what they wanted to achieve in terms of preventing Western Europe having an independent policy. And that's what this is all about. But of course, we are the ones who are going to lose out here. The Russians are going to be all right, just about. They're losing quite a lot of soldiers, which makes them very angry, because there could have been a negotiated solution to this war this time last year. But Boris Johnson, you remember him, the blondie one? He turned up in Kiev and told them that they'd got to fight on because the British and the Americans weren't interested in peace. And we are largely responsible for the continuation of the war.
Okay, so what do you think?
What
do you think Macron and von der Leyen are doing over in China? Then they're just about to head back home, aren't they?
Well, at the moment, the Chinese won't take Biden's phone calls. So Biden's been trying to phone Xi Jinping, and Xi Jinping has just been refusing to take phone calls, probably because Biden said, "Name me a world leader in the world who wants to change places with Xi Jinping." Which is a pretty silly thing to say, and he's offended them, and also, you know, the general belligerent attitude they've taken, the Chinese aren't prepared to talk to them at all. But von der Leyen and Macron, on the other hand, have been given, you know, carte blanche, as it were, by the Brits and the Americans to go and see if they can get Xi to lean on Putin to do what they want. It's a hopeless task. Because it's not in China's interest to do that. In the past, they've obviously accepted a visit from France, but the French were one of the guarantors of the original Minsk agreements, as were the Germans.
Well, so they can't be trusted then?
Well, yeah, but it's obvious that they aren't really in a position to promise anything. And the Chinese have already made their peace plan clear. In their 12-point peace plan for Ukraine, and the Russians have said that they're prepared to consider what the Chinese you've got to go back to the Minsk agreements, which, of course, we're determined not to do, so the war goes on.
What's coming out of Beijing, Martin, is that Macron is saying he can count on President Xi to bring Russia and Ukraine to the negotiating table. He told Chinese President Xi Jinping in Beijing yesterday that he can count on the Chinese leader to bring Russia to its senses and bring the warring sides in Ukraine to the negotiating table. I know I can count on you to bring Russia to its sense and to bring everyone back to the negotiating table, Macron said.
Well, he can say that, but the problem is the British and the Americans don't want to negotiate. They've made it absolutely clear that we, Boris Johnson said so, and I don't think Keir Starmer disagrees with him, or Rishi Sunak. We are going to fight until every centimetre of the Ukrainian state created in 1991, almost by accident,
captured.
Otherwise, Russia will have won. The Russians are prepared to negotiate. They've always been prepared to negotiate. The people who are stopping the negotiation here are us, the British government.
Do you think Macron and von der Leyen are over there trying to bribe Xi Jinping to pull away from his support that there's been so far for the Russians?
What are they going to bribe him with? What have they got to offer Xi Jinping?
Well, we don't know, do we? It could
no,
be.
France is not a big enough player.
Martin, just do listen to the answer, because they could then say, well, we can put pressure on the Americans to, you know, lay off the sanctions and the trade war with China, maybe.
Yes, and then I think the Chinese have allowed them to come out of good manners. You know, if they want to come, they've not been as nasty to us as the Americans and obstructive and what have you. Let's talk to them. But they're not expecting anything much from them. Macron is not in a position to tell either Rishi Sunak or Joe Biden what the policy on the Ukraine is. It's quite clear that France and Germany are being told by the Americans and their British glove puppets. They decide the policy. I mean, the French in the past have had a more independent-minded policy, like under de Gaulle and so on. And, of course, Marine Le Pen is calling for France to leave NATO. Now, when we get Rishi Sunak and Jacob Rees-Mogg saying it's time for Britain to leave NATO, then we can start talking about sovereignty in this country. In actual fact, NATO is at the centre of the deep state in this country, and it's run by the United States of America, who are themselves in the pockets of the Israelis.
Yeah, and it's based in... I want to go off on a bit of a tangent here. Because Brussels is the centre of a NATO. It's also the centre of the European Union. And if we go back to 2000, it's a long time, near a quarter of a century ago now. Actually, a quarter of a century ago, it was all going on. There was the biggest demonstrations that Belgium has ever seen over something called the De Tru scandal. And as I might have mentioned a few weeks ago, good old Google, you know, the YouTube lot, sent me a bizarre email saying I've got to take off this documentary about the De Tru scandal off of the internet because it's what is it exactly they said? Oh, that's right, it's owned by a fashion magazine in America and that they've claimed the rights to it. I mean, they're really just taking the mickey, but they shouldn't be taking the mickey because it's a very important documentary. It's a very good documentary by Alenka Frankel, done for a BBC correspondence series. We're going to hear a clip from that now, the Brussels BBC correspondent De Tru paedophile scandal, and this is a little excerpt from that that gives you an idea of the hideous things that were being done in Brussels back in the 1990s, and also around about 2016, early 2016, an article was in the it was in various papers. It was in the Mail and the Express, etc. An interview with De Tru's lawyer, which explained that they had actually got the finance and the plans for an underground city underneath Brussels, which would be a kind of paedophile's paradise with loads of young kids being kidnapped and there for their sexual pleasure and then being murdered afterwards, which is basically what De Tru was beginning back in the 1990s. So let's have a listen to this clip from this Brussels BBC correspondent documentary now.
De Tru was finally caught when his white van was identified. It had been used to snatch a sixth girl miles away from his home patch. The man who arrested De Tru was Jean-Marc Connerot, an investigating magistrate. He became a national hero, uniquely respected by the parents of the murdered children.
Yes, someone who wants to know the truth, you can feel it. When you talk to him, you can feel that he wants to investigate, that he wants to have the truth. He is a very good magistrate.
Connerot arrested De Tru's associates. Among the first was Jean-Michel Nihoul. Nihoul and De Tru had been seen at the site of the latest abduction the night before. They'd been in constant phone contact the day it happened. And the next day, Nihoul gave £10,000 worth of drugs to an accomplice of De Tru. One witness claimed Nihoul had ordered a girl. Connerot knew Nihoul had influential friends. He suspected he was the brains behind a network supplying clients with children to abuse. It's a charge Nihoul denies. Connerot appealed to the public for information.
When I saw him walking down the stairs, I thought that I knew everything about him. It was a shock. I thought, finally, they stopped him.
Regina Loof was one of the first to come forward. She said that as a child, she'd been abused for many years in a paedophile network involving Nihoul and De Tru.
I remember Jean-Michel Nihoul as a very cruel man. He abused children in a very sadistic way.
She says that at the age of 12, she was taken with other children to sex parties. And, she told investigators, De Tru was there, working for Nihoul.
De Tru was a boy who brought drugs, cocaine and something like that, to these parties, who brought some girls, or watched girls on these parties. Nihoul, he was a sort of party beast. And De Tru was more on the side.
Nihoul denies he's ever met Regina Loof, but her story's never changed. Nihoul, she said, was one of those who organized the parties and invited the cream of Belgian society, judges, politicians, and influential businessmen, in order to compromise them.
It was big business, yeah. And it was very well organized, too. There's a lot of money going on there, and a lot of blackmail also. They had a lot of parties. They filmed it even. So yes, yes, it exists. I know it sounds crazy. And I know that there is a big taboo on everything like that. But it exists, you know.
Regina Louf's story was horrific, but her account of a violent paedophile underworld was by now reinforced by new witnesses, some of whom also named influential people. The investigation began. The witnesses' identities were protected. Each was given a code name beginning with X. Regina was X1. They went up to X9. Their testimonies became known as Belgium's X-Files. The task of trying to verify them fell to a young police investigator.
So we're telling stories we haven't heard before in our lives, things we couldn't believe at the first. So we told ourselves, is this true? Could this be true? And when it is true, it's frightening that things like that could happen. We had a special room for the interviews. It was specially equipped for people who have been victimized by such matters. There was a camera in the room. They were done mostly in the evening or the early hours. When the interviews were finished, they were written down by a few people of my team, all the way from the first word to the last, literally.
But before the investigation could get underway, there was a bombshell. Jean-Marc Connerot, the man who'd arrested Dutroux, who'd saved the imprisoned girls, was sacked from the case.
Yes, so that's Alenka Frankel, Martin, talking on the BBC back in 2000. She herself there talks about blackmail. Of course, we had the Finnish, was it Prime Minister or whatever, over in on Monday this week, accepting accession to NATO. So that's in the very self-same city where Dutroux was planning to set up an underground city packed with kidnapped children.
Well, the Dutroux case is linked to the deep state and to NATO. So it's not just a question of paedophilia. It's a bit like this Jimmy Savile, the Epstein cases. This is how the intelligence services work. They do this sort of stuff and they blow things up and they assassinate people and they're involved in the drugs trade and they run the banking system and they control the police force. So these are the kind of things we're dealing with. But the record going back decades now is overwhelming about how NATO actually operates. And of course, it doesn't really matter what you or I think about this, Tony. What really matters is that the Russians know all about this stuff.
Well,
and they are determined not to give it to NATO for good reason.
It's just worth reminding ourselves about the very close links between NATO and the Nazis.
Well, I mean, the Nazi intelligence structure was basically integrated into NATO at the get-go. So Reinhard Gehlen, who was the head of the Gestapo in Eastern Europe, becomes the head of the West German BND, the intelligence services. And the Eastern, what he said was, I've got loads and loads of agents inside the Soviet Union. Do you want them? And of course, the NATO intelligence services, oh, yes, we do. Thank you. And so it's not a surprise that this is the case. We've known about it for years. The BBC Two Time Watch series on Gladio by Frankovich came out in 1993. So we've known about all this stuff for years and years and years, but most of the population are, you know, blithely oblivious to it all. But ultimately, if people know what's going on, and some people do know what's going on, they're not, you know, ultimately what the war in Ukraine about is the Russian attempt to destroy NATO. And that is their goal. They're trying to destroy NATO. Let's hope they succeed.
Amen. So also, Martin, looking at Israel, Israel has hit Gaza and Lebanon after rockets have been fired. The US is refusing to condemn Israel for storming the Al-Aqsa Mosque too, which is pretty shocking. And apparently Israel is ready to attack Iran without any US help, says the chief of the IDF. Now, this, of course, is the backdrop to this, is the Well, I mean, mass protests against Netanyahu giving himself or trying to give himself immunity from prosecution whilst he's facing three serious criminal charges right now.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's two things going on. Those secular Israelis who are protesting against Netanyahu and his, you know, far-right religious government have got their own beefs with Netanyahu. By and large, the Palestinian population hasn't engaged, hasn't joined in these demonstrations because they see both sides as equally hopeless from their point of view. And if you've got the head of the IDF saying that we are going to attack Iran without any backup from the United States, that makes them a wild card, doesn't it? I mean, the United States itself can't really attack Iran when, after the assassination of Soleimani, when the Iranians fired their missiles at the US base in Kurdistan, the Americans made no response at all because they knew if they fired back, then it would start a full-on shooting war, which they would lose. What's also happening, of course, is with the accord, the Chinese brokered accord between Saudi Arabia and Iran, it's possible that a government may be able to be formed in Lebanon, which satisfies all sides. But of course, Hezbollah also fired missiles into Israel as a result of this attempt to, create an incident at the Al-Aqsa Mosque. And I think the Israelis are facing the possibility that if they go to war with Iran, then Hezbollah has got lots and lots of missiles and they're going to take out Israeli infrastructure.
Yeah, I mean, there is this sort of backdrop to all of this, which is this spiritual thing, which is the mentality amongst some Israeli leaders that God will come and help them, but by having a war, they can force the appearance of some kind of Jewish Messiah. We've had David Livingston on the show several times saying that actually that could be the Antichrist instead of a Messiah that pops up to their aid. But anyway, let's have a listen now to Tony Greenstein. He's the author of Zionism During the Holocaust, and he's a prolific blogger. And so I asked him about what he makes of the current unrest in Jerusalem at the Al-Aqsa Mosque, where the Israeli army have been going in and beating up worshippers, dragging them out, etc., as well as the political crisis with Netanyahu trying to give himself immunity from prosecution by altering the rules at the Supreme Court. So let's have a listen to Tony Greenstein now.
My name is Tony Greenstein. I'm a defendant in the Shenstone 5 trial currently taking place in Wolverhampton Court. I'm a long-standing Jewish anti-Zionist activist, co-founder of Palestine Solidarity Campaign, and I've recently brought out a book, Zionism During the Holocaust.
Can you just explain your position against Zionism? Because many Jews, you know, they may not agree with the Israeli government, but they do see that it makes sense for the Jews to have their own country.
Yes, I mean, many people unthinkingly think that. However, I'm opposed to any religious state, and religious state, which is a nationalist state, inevitably discriminates against those who are not of that religion. So I'm flatly opposed to it because the Jewish state has turned out to be a Jewish supremacist state, which is no different from, say, white supremacist state. So I'm opposed on all sorts of grounds, but Israel today is, if you like, showing what it's like with the terror and the pogroms against Palestinians, the violent attacks against the Al-Aqsa Mosque, land confiscations, house demolitions, and so on and so forth. So, I mean, that is Israel today.
What about what's going on over in Jerusalem at the moment? Because we've got a standoff with the Israeli authorities saying that the worshippers are in fact some sort of like hooligan rebels and they're dangerous, and the police have to go in and arrest them and beat them up inside the Al-Aqsa Mosque. I mean, that's at the conjugation of Passover and Ramadan.
Well, just imagine if it was Jewish worshippers in a synagogue in, say, Romania or Poland, and armed riot police went into the synagogues to drag them out and beat them up. I mean, you know, you would never hear the end of this. So what's happening in Jerusalem is just too outrageous for words. It's obvious. Israelis and Jews have no business in the Al-Aqsa Mosque. It is the property of the Muslims. Now, I happened, when I visited Israel many years ago, to go there, but I went there as a guest, a visitor, and I behaved according to the rules that they set out for visitors. No one questioned my right to just simply go and visit, but I didn't go to worship. And I didn't go to impose my own will. So what's happening today is really so despicable and so contemptible. It defies all words. And if Biden and the Americans, you know, were to apply the same standards they do to Afghanistan, Russia or any other country to Israel, then aid would have been cut off years ago.
It's a flashpoint, isn't it, this spot? And in fact, many Jews, well, some Jews anyway, say that the Al-Aqsa Mosque is in the way, and actually the Temple Mount is Jewish, and it's going to have to go ultimately.
Yes, there are nationalist zealots who use religion as a cover for wanting to destroy the Al-Aqsa Mosque in order to resurrect a third temple. I mean, these are messianic maniacs for whom the institution of live animal sacrifices will herald the return of the Messiah. But they are not in accordance with Jewish Orthodox tradition. There are notices on the walls of Haram al-Sharif or the Temple Mount which say Jews should not enter there, the reason being because if it is a site of the Second Temple, then it also contains what you call the Holy of Holies, where God met the high priest, in essence. And it's forbidden for anyone who's not a high priest, and there are no high priests today, to enter. And they could accidentally enter the Holy of Holies. So they're not ultra-Orthodox. They're religious. They're nationalist maniacs who use religion as an excuse. But Orthodox opinion has never deviated from that.
And we've also seen some absolutely amazing events going on in Israel, really ever since Christmas, building up and up over the last, certainly over the last few weeks, even more protests in the streets about the laws that Netanyahu is trying to bring in. So can you say something about that, Tony? It's pretty shocking to see so many people out in the streets. It looks a little bit like France, actually, so many people in the streets.
Yes, but it's not like France. France is where you have demonstrations of people of all colours and races and so on. In Israel, the demonstrators, the overwhelming majority, have been Jewish. Palestinian Arab citizens of Israel have not participated because it's a fight about what you call Jewish democracy. It's not about a fight for Israel, democracy in Israel as a whole. So issues of the occupation, the repression of Palestinians have been conspicuous by their absence. It's a fight within the ruling elite. I'm not saying it's not a very determined fight, but it is different from France and anywhere else. Now, I mean, there are all sorts of implications, of course, but we should not really forget that major point. It is not a fight for a democratic Israel. And their main bone of contention is the Supreme Court. Well, Supreme Court may be liberal for Jews, but it's racist towards Palestinians, and virtually all its verdicts have sided with the Jews in terms of land confiscation, demolitions, administrative detention, and so on. So it is a racist court that they're defending.
Well, also, the former head of Shin Bet, the Israeli MI5, has said that the country's in danger of descending into a dictatorship because Netanyahu is trying to get immunity from prosecution. He's currently being charged under 3 criminal counts of corruption and bribery.
Yes, of course, but what he means by dictatorship is a dictatorship of some Jews over other Jews. For Palestinian Israelis, it has always been a dictatorship. Look, if the people in the streets over the last month or 2 months had been Palestinians or Arabs, there would have been bloodshed. The police would have opened fire, as they have done on many other occasions where there's been Palestinian protests, like the Day of the Land in 1976, when I think 13 Arabs were killed. Jewish demonstrators are never subject to live fire. Arabs and Palestinians are. So there are fundamental differences over the way they react to the two communities.
And do you think Netanyahu will back down over this? He said he's going to put this legislation on hold, but it isn't going away. That's what he said.
I don't think he's going to back down, but I think he's going to be more tactically clever over it. I mean, he does have a problem, and there has been a mass reaction, but we're seeing the beginnings of a civil war within, if you like, the master race, but not a fight for democracy, which encompasses all Israeli citizens, still left the Palestinians, the West Bank and Gaza.
Now, I know you're facing jail, but even while you're in jail, copies of your book can be sold. Can you just tell us how people can get hold of it, and maybe give us a link to your blog as well?
Okay, well, if you want to obtain copies of my book, you better do it quickly, because I might not be around for much longer, and the email link is tonygreenstein, one word, 104@gmail.com. Otherwise, you can get it from Amazon, but it will be more expensive, and it does go towards Jeff Bezos, so I prefer you didn't do that. I have limited numbers of copies now. In fact, it's been selling very well. But otherwise, you might have to wait till I come out, whenever that might be. My blog is azvsas.blogspot.com.
Okay, you better give us the book's title and how much it is then.
Oh, it's Zionism During the Holocaust. It's about the history of the Zionist relations with anti-Semites and the Nazis, and it's £12.50 paperback, £18 hardback, including postage.
Okay, Tony Greenstein, thanks very much for joining.
That's okay. Thank you, Tony. Yeah.
So, Martin, what do you make of Tony's analysis there? I mean, I think it's, you know, we don't hear any of this in our mass media coverage, do we, about the, you know, the finer details about what's been going on at Al-Aqsa. Actually, there is the potential there for an enormous flare-up, a religious war breaking out.
Well, the first intifada was caused by Sharon, taking a load of riot police onto the Haram al-Sharif. And, of course, I have to point this out. The State of Israel, as originally agreed by the United Nations in 1948, doesn't include Jerusalem at all. They're not supposed to be there, but they are. And that's why we have a conflict
with
Jerusalem.
Martin,
they shouldn't be there at all.
Martin, apparently God says otherwise.
Yeah, but that's not the United Nations, is it? Now, if I say God says that the British should, get out of the Ukraine and stop supplying weaponry to neo-Nazis. But yeah, I'm not going to get my way, am I? Because my God isn't big enough to force that issue. And if the Israelis say that God said this, then, of course, other extremists can say, well, God says otherwise. My God's bigger than your God. Now, in actual fact, they shouldn't be in Jerusalem at all. If Israel is going to continue as a state at the end of World War III, it'll have to be within the boundaries agreed in 1948, which were very modest. Yes, you can have a state of your own. It's going to be this size, and it's going to be mainly on the coastal strip around Tel Aviv. You're definitely not having any more than that. And at the very beginning, they immediately took more than that. And then they took more than that in 1967. And they took the Golan Heights in 1973, and they've annexed the Golan Heights now. This is all land grabbing. Like, ooh, what was the guy that used to do that stuff? Oh, I know, Adolf Hitler. And we had to go to war because we said we're not having people doing land grabs. But there you are, doing land grabs.
Ultimately, yeah, so anyway,
it's not going to be acceptable to the population of Palestine or the population of the world. It's not going to be.
In the wonderful Free West, of course, we have a completely democratic system which elects a president who is the person that everyone thinks is it best placed to do the job. And we've been hearing lots and lots about a particular Republican candidate for president over the last couple of weeks. But I thought we'd have a look this week at a less announced, less media coverage Democrat candidate for president by the name of Robert F. Kennedy now. And we're just going to hear a quick clip of one of the news announcements over in the States where he's announcing his 2024 presidential campaign.
Tonight, one more person is entering the race to challenge President Joe Biden for the Democratic Party nomination. Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who is the son of Robert F. Kennedy and nephew of John F. Kennedy. Robert F. Kennedy Jr., filed to run for president today with the Federal Election Commission. President Joe Biden has not announced his reelection campaign yet. Kennedy joins Marianne Williamson, who also launched a campaign for the Democratic presidential nomination last month.
In 2020, I think it was, Laurent Guillenot, who's a French documentary maker, writer, journalist, he produced what I found an absolutely fascinating documentary, which is Israel and the Assassination of the Kennedy Brothers. And I will put a link up to that on our show page. I'll also email a link out for that documentary, which is like the sort of thing that they just will not put on the television at all, even though it's absolutely brilliant because it's critical of Israel. And Martin, can you just say something about that? Because the Kennedy assassination took place at a very important time, didn't it? Before the Six-Day War. But, for example, when Lyndon Johnson was in power, the USS Liberty incident happened, and one cannot imagine that being allowed to take place if JFK was still a president of the United States.
Well, like, you don't know, do you? Because it's a counterfactual. We do know that they were both assassinated, and quite clearly the deep state was involved in both assassinations, including the Israeli wing of that state.
Well, maybe to illustrate it better for
people, Palestinian who was unhappy with Robert F. Kennedy's views on Palestine. But of course, the bullets that killed Kennedy, Robert F. Kennedy, were fired from behind, and there were more of them than Sirhan had in his gun. He was a patsy.
Yeah, I mean, you know, what Laurent does in his documentary, what he does in the documentary is he points out that killing Kennedy was one thing, but actually the death of his brother. He was considering he was going to be running for president afterwards. So if he'd have succeeded, he would have immediately instituted a proper investigation into his brother's death.
Right.
That's why he had to be killed. But Laurent does an amazing job in making lots and lots of connections with the Israeli influence on this. And really what it was, as he puts it, is a successful attempt to make sure that the U.S. policy stayed pro-Israel's, pro-Zionist, and that there wasn't really a proper independent. I mean, if you remember, it was Jim Morrison, the Doors singer's father, who actually he had scrambled jets to retaliate against the attack by the Israelis on the Liberty, and Lyndon Johnson ordered them back home again to land back on his aircraft carrier in the Sixth Fleet, because Morrison's dad was an admiral. So anyway, let's have a listen now to something a bit more up-to-date. And this is Robert F. Kennedy. He is the eldest son of Bobby Kennedy. And his take on the real Anthony Fauci. And this is basically his platform that he's going to be running for president is in criticizing. So what the media like to use this silly term, anti-vaxxer. Well, no. Robert Kennedy is a vaccine skeptic, and he's quite right to be a vaccine skeptic, as I most definitely am. I've made a decision. I'm not going to have any more vaccines after the farce that was the mRNA. In fact, the very day, well, it wasn't a farce, was it? It was a tragedy, forcing people to, or persuading people to have these jabs, which are now, many of them are dying as a result. And there's a suppression also of the adverse effects against these things, and there's no proper regulation of these markets. So let's have a listen now to a clip of Robert F. Kennedy, who will be, we're told, running for U.S. president on the Democratic ticket against Joe Biden, in an interview about his book called The Real Anthony Fauci, who, of course, was in charge of the chief scientific advisor to the White House during the COVID pandemic.
There is liability protection. There's a cap with nuclear power plants. And that's called the Price-Anderson Act. At Congress, you know, the insurance company wouldn't insure them, which was the problem with the jab vaccines. It wasn't a bunch of hippies who looked at the vaccines and said they're dangerous. It was the insurance companies who said, you are too dangerous for us to insure. And Pfizer, what happened is, Pfizer, which was then called Wyeth, had a product in the early 80s when they started ramping up vaccines, and it was a diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis vaccine, a DTP vaccine. They knew that there was an injury rate because people started reporting injuries, But the CDC was telling the world it was one in a million serious injuries. Their internal documents show that they believed it was one in 15,000 who got permanent brain injury or death. And but then they NIH and Wyeth and UCLA funded a study at UCLA where they started, where they really did a controlled study, and they immediately found it was one in every 300 kids. The result of that, Pfizer, Wyeth at that time was saying, we are paying $20 in downstream liability for every dollar we're making a profit. They went to the Reagan administration and to the Democrats in Congress. This was, you know, everybody was at fault here. And they said, if you don't give us blanket freedom from liability, we are going to stop making vaccines and you will be out of a vaccine supply. So Congress passed and Reagan signed. Everybody was reluctant to do it. And but Reagan actually said to the company, why don't you just make the vaccine safe? And
good question.
And why is that? Because vaccines are unavoidably unsafe. And that phrase, unavoidably unsafe, is in the preamble to the Vaccine Act. The vaccine company said, holy cow, now we've got a product that is free from the biggest cause for every other medical. Every medicine kills somebody. You know, right. There's vulnerable subgroups. So, and it is, for most medicines, it's their biggest cost, paying those liabilities. So now the company said, holy cow, now we're completely free from that cost. They also, vaccines are the only company, the only product that never has to be safety tested. And the reason for that, it's an artifact of the CDC's legacy as the public health service, which was a quasi-military agency. That's why people at the CDC have military ranks like Surgeon General and they wear uniforms. And because it always had, the health agencies are tied, are very closely aligned with the military. And the vaccine program was conceived as a national security defense against biological attacks on our country. So they wanted to make sure that if the Russians attacked us with anthrax or some other biological agent, we could quickly formulate a vaccine, distribute it to 200 million American civilians with no regulatory impediments. And so they said, if we call this a medicine, we're going to have to do test it like you test medicines, which is usually a 5-year placebo-controlled, randomized, double-blind study. And you do it for 5 years because many medicine injuries have long incubation periods or long diagnostic horizons. So you need that long period of time to really make a cost-benefit analysis. Over the long term, are you saving lives? They said, we can't afford to do that. So their solution was, we won't call it a medicine. We'll call it a biologic, and we'll exempt biologics from safety testing. Now, none of the 72 vaccines that is currently mandated for our children has ever been safety tested against a placebo in preclinical trials. I made that statement for many years, and Tony Fauci said that I was wrong. I met with Tony Fauci in 2016 and Francis Collins with somebody from the Trump White House present. And I was with Del Bigtree and Aaron Seary and Lynn Redwood, who's a nurse practitioner. And I made I reiterated that statement to them. There's never been a single preclinical trial of randomized controlled placebo testing for any of the 72 vaccines. They said in front of the White House Observer, you're wrong. And I said to them, and show me one. So I knew they didn't exist unless they had them locked in a safe, because I had asked for them on freedom of information requests and they hadn't been able to produce them. So they just said, we're wrong, we'll get them to you. And they never did. It's the last I heard from them. So we sued them. Dell and Aaron and me for ICANN. We sued them, and after a year in 2017, after a year of litigation, HHS came back and said, you're right, we've never done any. So nobody knows the risk profile for any of those vaccines. So nobody can tell you with a scientific certainty whether any of those products are causing more deaths and injuries than they're averting. People say I'm anti-vaccine. I'm not. I'm pro-science and pro-safety testing. If there's a vaccine that is shown to work in a preclinical or in a randomized placebo-controlled trial, I 100% would support it. And by work, I mean that after 5 years, the vaccinated cohort is healthier than the unvaccinated cohort.
Yes, well, that's a little bit worrying, isn't it, when the unvaccinated are healthier. And, of course, you do need to have a kind of control group, and it's people like me so far. But anyway, Martin, do you think he's going to be manoeuvred out or bumped off?
Well, he's going to have an uphill struggle, let's put it that way. He might be able to get a head of steam up, as Bernie Sanders did previously, but he'll have to get all of those people and more. But it's not impossible. I mean, I might be prepared to vote for somebody like him in a Democratic primary if I was in the United States, just to see if we could get him onto the ballot paper. Interesting. But we'll have to see what happens with it, because you know what happened to his daddy. That can happen, can't it? We all know it can.
Well, it's a bit cheeky, isn't it? Because at the time they said it's the curse of the Kennedys, you know, but it wasn't, obviously. And like I say, I'll put a link up to Lauren Gionor's film, The Israel and the Deaths of the Kennedy Brothers. I think that's the title. It's something like that anyway. Also, on the subject that he was discussing there, which is this immunity from prosecution of the vaccine companies, there is this also a very good film, which I remember watching a year or two ago, by Andrew Wakefield, the so-called discredited Dr. Andrew Wakefield, a brilliant film called 1986, The Act, which goes into great detail on how it became, as he was, you know, quite quickly describing there, that these companies have got immunity from prosecution. We've seen quite a lot of this, aren't we? That where the government is just on the back foot and the big corporations are basically lording it over everybody. I agree with your criticism of Sandy Adams, Martin, saying it's communist. It looks much more like a fascist system to me, much more like a Fourth Reich.
Well, yeah, I mean, the bigger issues about who's what to call it is, in a sense, secondary. It's what is it, isn't it? I mean, you know, an obvious point to make is, why are the private sector dealing with the production of medicines at all? There's a strong case, especially in a country like us, Britain, where we have a nationalised health service, that all of that stuff should just be done in-house and with the strictest of safeguards, with no profit motive involved. A lot of the problem with the companies like Pfizer and Moderna and so on is because they're driven by the profit motive, and they're also manipulating the political process. Robert Cadledge, I think his name is, Lieutenant Colonel Cadledge, he's been the mastermind of US biological warfare stuff for years. He was in Trump's cabinet and all the rest of it. He looks like the prime suspect for the deliberate release of COVID-19. And I will repeat that it does exist. And why do I believe it exists? Because somebody like Jeffrey Sachs, who was on the board of The Lancet, has made it clear that it's quite obvious that the virus has been modified. Now, if the virus has been modified, that implies that there is a virus to be modified, does it not?
Yeah, and I don't know if you noticed when Mark Purdy was speaking, bless him, earlier on, he was saying it's easy for the government to blame a virus because viruses are not yet mass manufactured. And he used the word yet because obviously they are. Nowadays, and this of course is a very dangerous development. Anyway, look, Martin, we're going to move on to our final sort of spiritual side now, but before we do, we're going to be hearing from Sandy about the Abbey of Thelema and about an Aleister Crowleyite organization which has been popping up in up down in Glastonbury. What do you make of Crowley? Because he's also, you know, he was quite an interesting figure, wasn't he? Mainly during, around about the time of the 1930s and during the Second World War. because he did actually see himself as an Antichrist figure, and he was a bit of a, you know, devious organizer. But what do you make of Crowley?
Well, he's a sort of bête noire for some people and a sort of countercultural hero for others. I generally tend to think
a hero.
Sorry,
a hero.
Well, to some, but not to me. I mean, a lot of it is just obscurantist, frankly. It's people want to have esoteric knowledge. He was one of those that wanted esoteric knowledge. Loads of people like to think of themselves as having esoteric knowledge. But do you really know the difference, you know, between...
Oh, well, I mean, he was invited...
That's another question, isn't it?
He was invited to Oxford University, apparently, by the Poetry Society to give a recitation. And then the university officials stepped in to stop that, saying, you know, we don't really want a Satanist here doing poetry readings. And the letter, The Guardian, published that. I think probably today they wouldn't even bat an eyelid if that sort of thing happened. You know, so there's a couple of anecdotes.
I mean, having mad ideas, can you?
Well, you may say
you,
it's
you, you don't have to agree with them, but you're not going to stop them having those mad ideas, are you?
You know, but it depends if it's evil, doesn't it? I mean, that's what it shows, I suppose. We're living in a much more secular world now, where Oxford University sees itself as a secular thing. Back in those days, it wasn't necessarily so much. But I did have a chat to somebody once who passed Aleister Crowley on the stairs of a bookshop, and she said that she was getting... it's blackouts for 2 days afterwards and migraines. Yeah. So that's just passing him on a staircase in a bookshop. The other thing, of course, is that Dennis Wheatley took him to dinner and ended up writing one of the great occult novels of the 20th century called The Devil Rides Out, which is also available as a Hammer film if anyone is interested. But that book is really about a woman who she gets sucked into a satanic cult. And her mates do their very best to get her out of it. And I won't tell you how it ends because it's a terrific yarn. But anyway, let's have a listen now to Sandy Adams' final clip from her. And we can say goodbye to you, Martin. Thanks very much for being with us and a very merry, happy Easter to you. I hope you're enjoying it and you continue to do so. And this is her talking about this rather nasty satanic ritual, which is going on tomorrow, Sunday and Monday down in Glastonbury.
My father, he was a squadron leader during the war, and he won the DFC, and he died thinking we'd won the war. And I look at it now and I thought, Dad, you know, bless you, you know, it wasn't, it carried on, it's been carrying on ever since, you know. Yeah. You know, we had Operation Paperclip and all that nonsense, and it's never gone away. The evil has never gone away. It's always
it seems to have transferred itself into a kind of banking Reich, if you want, you know, a kind of Fourth Reich where they use banks instead of tanks to take over. So getting back to Glastonbury at the weekend, what's happening?
So we're in a big battle between the dark and the light. So Glastonbury's always been a bit of a nonsense place, you know, because it's got a very high history of, you know, the very first Christian church was built here in something like, I don't know, AD 60 something, and it's got a very, you know, deep history of being a very stable religious place, and people have come here, and there's been pagan, obviously it was pagan before that, and people have sort of always danced around maypoles, and it's all been fun, you know. You kind of embrace all the, you know, okay, paganism is fine, it was there before Christianity, why not, you know, all of that sort of thing. But lately it's become incredibly dark, and I've seen it because I've lived here for over 16 years now, and I thought, do you know, I went to the last May Day celebration, which was always a bit of fun. It was maidens dancing around a maypole, and it was all a bit, you know, everybody drinking mead. And I used to go to it every now and then. But last year it was dark. You know, there were people wearing horns and dressed up as goats, and women with no clothes on and just horns. And it just suddenly took on this rather dark, you know, this rather dark aspect to it, and I thought, you know, it's not like it used to be. And obviously the more I've read in the last 3 years about the satanic stuff that we're encountering, it's deeply uncomfortable. I find it deeply uncomfortable what's going on, because I'm more aware, and I think an awful lot of people have really realise that there is the deepest evil going on in the world, and when you look at what, you know, what's going on with a lot of the globalists and Hollywood and everything else, you begin to question everything, and I certainly have. And what I thought was just like crystals and, you know, new age stuff has suddenly gone a bit darker. And and sure enough, there's a group that started set up here, and they follow the work of Aleister Crowley, and it's called Avalon Thelema, and they're doing a ritual, they call it a ceremony, at the Market Cross on the 8th, 9th and 10th of this month. Obviously it's Easter weekend. And why it's got to be 3 days, I don't know. But they're reciting it's the Book of Law, which is actually one of Aleister Crowley's deepest, you know, sort of works on Thelema. In the Oracle, it says here, it says, join Avalon Thelema at 12 noon at Glastonbury Market Cross on the 8th, 9th and 10th of April to celebrate a feast for the 3 days of the writing of the Book of Law. Yeah.
And okay, brilliant.
Also got something else happening, which I didn't like at all, because it's called the Feast of Cattle, and they're holding another event in it's the Temple of Avalon on the Saturday, the 29th of April at 6 p.m. It's a Thelemic Beltane ceremony. All are welcome. Donations would be great. It's a celebration of Sol in the succedent decan of Taurus, hosted by Avalon Thelema. Apparently, it's celebrating, I think it's the goddess Nut and two other gods or goddesses. No, it's very Babylonian. It's kind of anyway. Well,
look, this is an underground religion which is just poking its nose out now. You know, it's been kind of doing that for a while, but it's obviously chosen Glastonbury seems to be the place it wants to do it.
This is deeply dark, and of course the mayor's got involved in it, and everybody's all the. You know, I did laugh about it, thinking, someone said to me, it sounds like Hot Fuzz. I don't know if you ever saw that film where this young policeman turns up in this backward sort of Somerset village, and he finds out that they're all Satanists, you know, dancing naked round pentacles. Anyway, I just suddenly thought this isn't really something, and they're doing it right on that powerful ley line, you know, right on the Michael Mary line. So what is really going on? And these people have just turned up in town, and they seem to be making lots of contacts with quite influential people, like all the politicians and members of the Green Party and people that are sort of, you know, real kind of, you know, people that organize events and that are sort of all in this kind of new age let's make Glastonbury a tourist attraction type thing. And, you know, these people are, you know, what are they doing?
How do you think this is going to go down in Glastonbury?
Well, I'm absolutely stunned that an awful lot of people are going along with it and thinking it's all cool. Whether they really haven't looked at the work of Aleister Crowley, I don't know. But all I know is they are expecting quite a big crowd around the Market Cross. And there's people that I know were sort of into paganism, you know, and they think it's paganism. They can't see the difference. I mean, yes, you know, a pantheistic sort of, they might think of a pantheistic. Christianity at the moment is not sexy enough. You know, that's the trouble. And people want something that's different and liberal and whatever. But, you know, when it's peddling, you know, stuff that you wouldn't want your children to see, then it's not good, is it?
Well, no. Anyway, the guy who's organising it's called John Crow. He's got his kind of pictures up there on Facebook and various other places. Thanks very much to Sandy for reporting on that. He looks kind of like a bit of an unhappy guy, and that reminds us, of course, that Jesus loves Satanists too. In fact, many would say that Jesus actually came for Satanists and for anybody that's opposed to Christ particularly. I mean, that's what they seem to be. But it's quite clear what's been going on in Glastonbury is that this kind of innocuous paganistic stuff like the crystals, etc., is slowly
being subsumed by a much darker group or groups moving in on it all. And I thought we'd finish tonight by having a listen to, since we've been talking about the Kennedy family, we'll have a direct chat with the guy that actually shot JFK, blew the back of his head off with a Remington Fireball rifle from the grassy knoll. That is James Files. I personally have got no doubt whatsoever that he did the job. And there's a fantastic longer interview with him, which was done, I think it was around about 2010 or 2012 or something. And so we're going to hear now about him and about how Jesus Christ found James Files when he was in his prison cell. And this is the second interview that was done with James Files. But there's a clip, and here he talks about his role there on the grassy knoll, about some of the characters involved in the Kennedy assassination, the fact that it was David Attlee Phillips at the CIA that was really behind it. He was the controller for the job, and that he brought the Chicago mafia hitmen down from Chicago down to Dallas to do the job on the day. And so let's have a listen now to James Files, the shooter from the grassy knoll, the Kennedy assassin. And let's also have a listen to his encounter with Christ.
They tried to make Kennedy believe he shouldn't go to Texas, that he should be afraid of Texas. And they worked on his ego, said, you got to use the bubble top. You have to have the top on. You can't sit in an open car. You got to let these, whatever they think, you got to let them think, you know, you're afraid of whatever. But there's a high risk here. You got to have the top on. The more they worked on Kennedy about this, the more he wanted to top off. Kennedy wanted to prove, I'm not scared of anything. I want the top off. I want to wave to the people. I want to see the people. I want to touch the people. So they played on his ego. The top was off.
Are you aware that David Ferry was involved, among many other things, in cancer research?
I did not know David Ferry was involved in anything in cancer research. No, I did not.
Okay, so you got any thoughts about Jack Ruby's cancer? Do you think that was natural or unnatural?
I'm going to say it was injected. There's one thing I want to say. When you talk about David Ferry, for his cancer research, I have no knowledge of that at all. But I do know he liked to play around with hypnosis. I think he used it on a lot of young kids. Because he was in charge of the Civil Air Patrol.
Yeah, for a second, back to that bubble top. What would you have done if it would be on?
Well, back to the bubble top on the car. If they'd have had the top on, it was a walkaway. But we would have known that before he ever got to the plaza, because we would have been informed if they come out and they picked him up and they got the top on, they're not going to remove the top during the motorcade. Nobody would have been there. None of us would have been on hand to watch John F. Kennedy come down through there, because I could care less about seeing the man. But if the top would have been on, I would have already been on my way back to Mesquite, and I'm quite certain that Mr. Nicoletti and Roselli would have been on their way somewhere else.
So if it would have rained, it was a no-go?
If it was still raining, it was no-go. But when you plan something, all you can do is hope for the best. Like a football, you know, you got to make the play. Seconds are running out. You go for the long one. If it works, it works. It don't. You walk away.
To your knowledge, there was no plan B.
Pardon me?
To your knowledge, there was no plan B.
No backup.
There was no backup plan for that. The only backup plan we had for that was if the top is on, it's a no-go.
Here's some questions Pam has for you. What has changed in your life in recent years?
I think probably the biggest change in my life is, and let me go back just a little bit farther. Before this change took place, I had no emotions or no feelings, basically speaking, for anyone at all. My family never came first. The agency came first. Crime family came first. Everybody was always ahead of my wife and my kids. Wrong? I know that. I know that now. I've got probably a lot of regrets, maybe some remorse for a lot of the things that I did do. I'm sorry at times I wasn't there to see my kids go to their little school plays or do their dances, recitals, or whatever. I'm sorry I wasn't there for their birthdays, for a lot of their Christmases. But those things are part of my life growing up. These are things that I accepted because, to me, other things were more important. My family, my wife, my kids, they were way down on the list of priorities. Wrong, I know. After I got here, when I got here, this place was pretty well wide open. Place was very violent, wild. And you know, we just had recently had several lockdowns due to deaths here. It wasn't natural. But a few years ago, What happened to me was, I went to sleep one night. I had a lot of hate in me. I had a lot of anger in me. I had a list of names. Boy, I want to start writing down names, and I want this person, I want that person. A lot of hate in me. But I woke up during the night. I found Jesus sitting by my bunk. A lot of people say, oh, it's a dream. Maybe it was a dream. It's a dream to you, a dream to him. To me, it's real. And I'll ask him, I says, what are you doing here? And he said, I've come to tell you, there's only one way. He said, the Father sent me to tell you. He said, that I'm for real, God is for real, that I'm for real. He says, the only way to the Father is through me. So we said, we talked for a little while, and I went back to sleep. The next morning, I woke up, all the hate was gone. I used to wake up and come out of my cell every morning. It's not, what am I going to do today? It's who am I going to have to kill today, or who am I going to have to stab today, or who's going to try to stab me, who I got to fight, you know. Because there have been a lot of fights here, a lot of stabbings. But I had a new feeling in me. I was real light. You know, I felt like I loved everybody. You know, hey, how you doing? Boom. I talked to people I never talked to before. I even talked to the cops. Hey, how you doing? What's going on? Hey, nice day. Well, after a little while, I started slipping back again. I got back to being the old Jimmy again. I started getting these angry feelings back, wanting to fight. You know, you look at me the wrong way, I'm going to grab you, slam you into the wall, you know. Whatever you do. I got a second visit. And when I got the second visit from Jesus, it's really got my attention. And at this point, I'd already heard from this one girl, this one lady. I don't know if I should name her on tape or not. But I become romantically involved. I fell in love with her. And I love her with all my heart. Probably love her more than I've ever loved anything in my life. But we were talking and writing, and she was a good Christian lady, and she had told me a few different things. And so the second visit I got, Jesus told me to get my life in order. The Father was going to call me home. I thought, well, Jesus, I'm going to die. And I'm going to die right away. And so I told her on the phone. So she was crying a little bit. You know, I was a little sad over, you know, this and that. But then I was reading in the Bible, and I was reading in Matthew chapter 24 about the earth giving the birth pains and all this. What God was telling me, Jesus was telling me, God's not calling me home this stage of the game, but be prepared. Get ready for heaven so I can have a life hereafter. And I'm reading all about this in Matthew. And then it struck on me what it was. So I called her up and I told her. And so, but like I say, since then, I've lived a whole different life here. I used a few words of profanity in this interview strictly for the reason of what was said. There was actual words verbatim. But when I'm not in this interview, I try not to use vulgar language. I try not to hate people. I try to maintain good thoughts. But in here, that's hard to maintain good thoughts. Very hard in here. But I work at it very hard. And I pray every night, every day. I don't run around with my Bible. I don't run around trying to tell you all about the Word of God. That's not my job. You want to hear about it, I'll be more than happy to sit down and talk to you about it. But I don't try to push it on anybody.
Well, that's the voice of James Files, Chicago mob hitman. Interviewed a few years ago, much longer interview. I'll put a link up to on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, giving his take on his spiritual development, as well as giving us a few insights into some of the workings behind the assassination of JFK. And I'll just wind up by offering up a prayer for Robert Kennedy and his presidential bid, really just for protection, and that he does feel able to continue with the bid, and that he's not thwarted in that, because it's obviously quite an important thing in the United States, which is why, of course, it's been played down in the press here. Time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, particularly also, of course, to Maz Salim for her contribution, and to sound engineer Dave Bozanko. Do please send me interviews and story tips on the Not the BCFM Politics Show page, where you'll find the podcast, full-length interviews, story links, comment page, and our email addresses. You can also subscribe to my weekly email list at thisweekoneword.org.uk. If you've got comments, etc., that's the place to go. And here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable Easter weekend. We've been streaming from the People's Republic of Stoke-Scott, although we're not actually in the studio there, on the talkradio.org.uk stream and at radioquk.com in Camberley, Surrey. Also live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app. And do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show live stream on talkradio.org.uk at 5 o'clock next Friday. God bless. Have a happy Easter. And don't let the Masonic banksters get you down.